Dana Gould Hour.
Jungle worms and swamp rats, run around your feet.
Well, why do I get hooked up with these spook details? Monsters, graves, bodies. Oh, all right.
Trick or treat, trick or treat, trick or treat on Halloween. Trick or treat on Halloween. Never any tricks, but lots of treats on your Halloween station. Here's a salutation. A musical treat from your Halloween station. Happy Halloween!
Tune in, it's a gas. It's the Dana Gould Hour.
Trick or treat! It's that time of year, everybody, and everyone is getting into the Halloween spirit. Everybody's in a mask, and the world itself is dressed up as its favorite scene from Contagion. But we will proceed undaunted. Today's episode is brought to you by MyBookie. Winning seasons return at MyBookie, and winning season means Survivor, Super Contests, and Squares. Invest in your intuition. Use the promo code Dana and double your first deposit. New players get up to $1,000 in free play, and that's at mybookie.com. We have an excellent episode in store for you, as well we should. It's Halloween. Rob Zabrecki is here. Now, you may know Rob from his previous role as the lead singer for Possum Dixon, but he has since gone on to create Zabrecki, a magician of note and renown. Among his many skills and duties was running the famed Houdini Seance at the Magic Castle here in Los Angeles. And he is here to discuss not only Houdini, but Houdini's wife's attempts to contact him from beyond the grave, and how that went, and how it came to involve the original Disney Imagineers. You heard that right. We also have, get ready for a name butchering, Laurent Bouzereau. Laurent has directed, among other things, the excellent Natalie Wood documentary What Remains Behind, currently on Netflix, as well as the amazing Richard Zanuck doc, Don't Say No Until I Finish, which I have referred to on this podcast. He has just finished work on archiving and curating the Alfred Hitchcock Classics Collection. Say that a couple times fast. The brand new 4K Ultra HD combo pack, which includes the uncut version of Psycho, as well as restored prints of The Birds, Rear Window, and Vertigo. Each film comes with a butt ton of extras and bonus materials, and that is what we are here to discuss. What's up with little old me? Well, if you are a ticket holder to the Sleepy Hollow Virtual Film Festival, you can enjoy a special screening of Glenn or Glenda, with a live commentary by myself, along with Ed Wood screenwriters Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, as well as Frank Conniff and Trace Ballou of Mystery Science Theater 3000 and The Mads. That's going up on October 20th, but it will be up for a while. Then we're going to try to get it up onto the Patreon page, but play it safe and go to SleepyHollowFilmFest.com. And on October 29th, it's Plan 9 from Outer Space Live, this time on Zoom so everyone can see it. Starring yours truly, Kat Ogison, Maria Bamford, Bobcat Goldthwaite, Deborah Baker Jr., David Koechner, Gary Anthony Williams, Lorraine Newman, Oscar Nunez, Bob Odenkirk, Jonah Ray, Paul F. Tompkins, Janet Varney, Baron Vaughn, with live music by Eben Schletter, and miniature special effects starring one of the original flying saucers from the original Plan 9 from Outer Space. And these effects will be created and provided by the brilliant Mike Carano. Now, all you need to see this baby is to go to sfsketchfest.com. sfsketchfest.com and get your tickets. And then watch it from the comfort of your home. Lastly, before we get going, let me say a quick word about our Patreon program. We're a special show, and our Patreon reflects that. We don't have graduated levels. For $37, I'm not going to come to your house, make hash browns. $5. Just $5 makes you a Dana Gould Hour Sky Cadet. And that gives you access to all sorts of extras, bonus interview segments, a handsome Dana Gould Hour Sky Cadet sticker for your car, skateboard, or guitar case. This month, our Patreon bonus is Volume 4 of Dana's old-timey Halloween mix. This one, a swinging collection of garage rock classics from the 50s and 60s. If you have never heard Go Go Gorilla by the Shondells, I have to thank our guest Rob Zabrecki, actually, for helping me curate this collection. So go now to danagould.com and sign up. $5 a month. That gets you all you need. But put a pin in that. For now, sit back, pull your mask down, grab a bag of candy, and enjoy our filthy Halloween business. It's Halloween, and I immediately thought of our first guest, not only because he's thematically consistent with the idea behind the show, but he's one of my close friends, and I will seize on any opportunity to talk to him. Please welcome a rock star and a magician. No, not the Oak Ridge Boys. Please welcome Rob Zabrecki.
And this is the sound of my voice, Dana.
You were not in the Oak Ridge Boys, is that correct?
Not that I can remember, but there was a couple of years that were a little cloudy. So it's possible I sat in or moved amps.
My guess is no one wants anything to do with any Oak Ridge girl. That's my guess.
That's a pretty good guess.
So how's your pandemic?
It's very similar to yours. Mm-hmm. you know, just learning to live in a confined space and trying to stay creative and, you know, also limber, you know. One of the things I've been lucky enough to do is a yoga class every Sunday. One of my good friends is a yoga instructor. And she
is it like a Zoom class?
It is. It is a Zoom class. And last week there were 20 participants, 20 students, I guess you'd say. And some are couples, you know, sharing a space, but they come in from all over the world. There's people from, you know, the UK and certainly East Coast and other countries as well. So it's kind of in some ways, it's the hour I look forward to most all week because, A, I get some physical, you know, exercise. And then, B, I get to see friends that, you know, I normally wouldn't probably see anyway. So that's kind of great.
Yeah, I did a thing for the Sleepy Hollow Film Festival, which is, you know, it's all virtual this year. And me and Frank Conniff and Trace Ballou from Mystery Science Theater and Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who wrote Ed Wood and Dolomite and everything, we watched and did a commentary on Glenn or Glenda.
Amazing.
And yeah, we did about 10 minutes of commentary, and then we were just like, so how are you? Like, it was just so great to see people. Because they're all friends.
We've all seen this movie.
Yeah, they're all personal friends. You know, I was like, remember when we went to a restaurant? Do you remember that?
I know.
We were watching a movie, and it was some dumb romantic comedy. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was a really smart romantic comedy. We were flipping the channels and Bridesmaids was on, and it was the scene in the airplane. And we were like, look at that. It was like seeing people in a stagecoach. It's like, remember traveling like that? You could just go anywhere.
It was so insane.
It's like we've lost all sense of time, and it seems like it was 100 years ago, but yet, you know, a year ago we would be on a, I was on a plane a year ago.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not only that. You know, it's great how human beings can adapt. In addition to the pandemic, if you're an aware person, if you're involved in the world and you have empathy for people and you also have a news source, it's a terribly punishing time to be alive. As someone said, the president of the United States doesn't govern the country. He harasses it. And it's like we're all kids in a house where dad is a violent drunk. And we're all just trying to find ways to get to the end of the day. And what'll be interesting is when this year is all over and, or this period of time is all over, when we have a more human person at the head of our government and we're able to resume our lives again because of some sort of vaccine or some such, we're all going to have tremendous PTSD. And I really want to know how it manifests itself. 50% of the country is going to become a stripper. You know, it's like, it's going to be like,
yep.
There's going to be just so much damage and walking wounded and people with eating disorders.
For sure. I mean, I guess the best thing we can hope, though, is that dad does pack up his suitcase and gets kicked out of the house on November 3rd.
It's leaning that way, but yeah.
Yes, it is leaning that way, but let's just hope that that's a firm reality. I won't
believe that Dracula's dead till I see his skull dissolve.
There you go.
That's my theory. But people do find ways to adapt. I'll give you two examples, and then it goes right into we'll get right into your project. I love, as you do, like I love. Halloween's my Christmas. And the great thing about living in Los Angeles is there are so many Halloween related events. And one of my favorites was the Griffith Park Haunted Hayride, which of course they can't do because of COVID-19, but they redesigned it for cars. And you have to drive down to San Dimas, God's country. And they built this thing in the parking lot of Raging Waters, where it's a drive-through maze, and then they have like a miniature drive-in movie experience with people running around. And it was great. And everybody had a great time, and we had a blast. And I just felt so good about like, yeah, we figured out a way. We figured out a way to do this. And everybody was great. You know, it's like,
wow. Yeah.
You know, everybody had a shared experience, and everybody was polite in traffic and waved people through and laughed and smiled and beeped. And it wasn't, there were no ass. Everybody was there for the same reason. It was great. And then my daughter, who's 11 or 12, sorry, figured out what she wanted to be for Halloween. And we went to the costume store. We went to Halloween Town and we're making her costume because they don't make her the costume that she wants.
What does she want to be?
Mr. Krabs from SpongeBob, Mr. Krab.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then her cousin, her best friend, is going to be...
Let me guess. May I guess?
Please.
I'm going to go with Patrick.
Yes. Oddly, neither one of them SpongeBob. And what's so funny is Clancy Brown, the voice of Mr. Crab, is our backyard neighbor. And I said, amazing. Oh, you know, that's Clancy. He's the voice of that. She's like, oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess he's your neighbor. You don't really care.
Not jumping the fence for an autograph.
No, they can't. He's our neighbor. We see him all the time. He's a great guy. Yeah. He's got two German shepherds.
That's funny.
Yeah, but they're just like, eh, whatever. But, you know, I don't know if they're going to go trick-or-treating or not, but they're going to dress up and we're going to do something. It's
wow.
You know, it's we have to do something. I've decorated the house. We got pumpkins. I'm not going to give in.
Well, let me know what you do, because I'm curious to see how you know people are going to navigate this Halloween. I'm usually working.
Past
20 years I've been doing one thing or the other during the week of Halloween and
yeah, it's your busy. It's both of our busy time.
This year I can't imagine. I imagine it'll just be like any other night, unless I can find something. Like go to San Dimas or something cool like that. But so far,
yeah, it was great. It was great. I know Tommy's not a fan of them, but they can't touch you.
Yes, that's the thing. Like, some of those haunted hayrides were absolutely some of the most horrifying moments I've ever had. They were so great.
Oh man.
And so well done. I just would look forward to going. And,
yeah, the among the hardest times I've ever laughed in my life was in the hay, you know, when you did the hayride, we're in the wagon and I was with a bunch of people I knew and Arden Marine, the very funny actress, comedian. And they had acrobats in bird outfits on these bendy poles, like from the last Mad Max movie. And they would dip down out of the trees over your wagon and dip back up. And it was great. But what was funny is Arden just kept screaming, "I hate my body."
That's great.
But in addition to people who perform for a living have also had to find a way to adapt. And I have not warmed up to Zoom comedy shows yet, because to me, stand-up is so much a conversation, you know, the best kind of conversation, the kind in which only I talk. But it's, you know, the waiting for the laugh that kind of doesn't come, it throws me. But there are really, there's a lot of stuff that I am doing that I find really interesting. Like we're doing Plan 9 live on Zoom, and we're finding ways to make that interesting.
Performing is such an ephemeral experience for the performer and the audience, and that's why we do it, you know, because for that very reason of being in the moment and feeling the breath and the smells and the whole that whole experience. And I've yet to have an online experience. Especially Zoom is probably more challenging than other platforms that people are been using, but I just have yet to respond well to, you know, people waving their fingers or wiggling their fingers to respond to you know, either a laugh or some kind of an applause cue. And it just everything about it feels wrong.
But Two-Headed Dreams, which is the show that you did that I also did, that was the most satisfying experience I'd had. Because it was totally presentational. So it wasn't hinged on anything coming back from the audience.
It also wasn't Zoom. It was a different platform. It was called Maestro was the platform that they used. So it had a different look. There wasn't a kind of, you didn't, there was no gallery view of your audience members. There was a comment bar on the side that it all looked a little more stylish. And there
describe for our podcast audience what Two-Headed Dreams is and when they can see the next one.
Oh yeah. Well, Two-Headed Dreams was a conceived a virtual magic show in which I hosted, say, 90 minutes of kind of the Zabrecki world. And for that, for those of you that don't know, it's its own place, like Pee Wee Herman's house is, like Pee Wee's Playhouse is a place, or like Elvira's house is a place, or Mr. Rogers' house is a place. So Becky's world got its own set of rules. And
there's an Addams Family. There's a great sort of Addams Family tone and aesthetic to Zabrecki's magic world, which I really, it's not Doug Henning.
Well, thanks. Yes. Hopefully it's its own thing. I don't even know what it is. It's a combination of so many things that
it's dark and it's wry and it's funny.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take that. Great. So this dark, funny, wry world that kind of exists. And then I was lucky enough to rope in people that I know and love, such as yourself. Penn and Teller joined me for a piece. My buddy Michael Carbonaro, who's got a popular TV show called The Carbonaro Effect. We had Puddle's Pity Party do a song. My dear friend Liberty Larson, and a close-up magician named Mike Pichotta from Magic Castle, who I've known for years, all come in and kind of do what they do best within a three-camera setup. So if those of you that didn't see it, Dana did this kind of this pre-show kind of warm-up, like here's what's going to happen, setting the tone for the thing. And then I came in and on a set, but see, now here's the thing. I was in a soundstage in Hollywood that was set dressed and it was a big space, And so it didn't feel like a Zoom show. You got three cameras going. So it was anything but.
It felt like the school play. It felt like it was a real show.
Exactly. Yes. And it was live. And so people could comment and chime in. And there was a point where you could kind of choose your own adventure. And there was different kind of rooms to go.
Well put.
Yeah. So it did have, we did try to capture some of that ephemeral quality where you could be like, okay, I've got to make a choice now. And so there were things about it that were pretty fun and exciting. And I think very soon that show will be available as a, something that people can look at. Hopefully, that the show will have been archived. So originally,
can you go back and access it and watch?
Yeah.
It?
So the fact that it was a three camera thing, enabled them to kind of hopefully assemble like a beautiful end piece where they can kind of edit out the, you know, some of the madness that in the moment that didn't really work. And so they're kind of refining that. And then hopefully we'll do Two-Headed Dreams in the next few weeks, maybe say a month. And try to just do it a little bit better. But again, a kind of Zabrecki and Friends type of show, virtual thing, pretty low ticket price.
It's great.
$25
so,
or
it's
something.
So great because it's also like it's the theme that I love, and you know, it's like what I got to do was the, you know, the comedy version of Rod Serling hosting the Night Gallery. You know,
which is what I do.
Yeah, exactly.
You're playing yourself.
I was so happy. Yeah. I was so happy. And I was in a sling. I was still in a sling from my surgery. So I couldn't move around as much as I wanted to, and then when you watch it, what I really loved about it is, oh, okay. They thought about this. This is a theme. It has a tone. It has a direction. Like, you know, the interstitials, there's a guy playing piano in a plague doctor's mask. You know, it's like you guys thought about, you didn't just throw up a camera, cut, regurgitate it onto the computer. You guys thought it through, had an idea, and it remained consistent. And that was why I was really happy and proud to be a part of it. You tried.
Well, thank you. I mean, as you know, consistency is a key ingredient or element in any artistic endeavor, you know. And when you're thinking about most Zoom shows, you see, it's, for example, right now people can hear us, they can't see us, but my background and what sits in back of me and what I'm wearing is much different than your background and what you're wearing at the
moment.
So Zoom shows were sort of,
for people who don't know, my house looks like the Madonna Inn on the way up to San Francisco.
It really does. Yes. And you've got a Liberace thing going on with your attire, which is super cool.
As I call him Lee.
Oh God. Anyhow, it's just, you know, we rely on so much of our sort of immediate backdrops in Zoom. But in this live thing, it was much different. And so hopefully we'll get to explore that a little bit more and just make it better than we did the previous time, which is always the goal.
That's the challenge, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think when the world restarts, this stuff will carry on? Like, I don't think we go back. You know, let's say before, say February 2020, we were at 5. And then COVID happens and now we've gone to 8. I don't know if we go all the way back to 5. I think we go to 6. I think there's a lot of meetings that are going to stay on Zoom, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. As much as it seemed like the end of the world that we're, you know, we would be sort of confined and had to do these things. But the more I learn about these meetings and how, in some ways, they save so much. They just on the earth, you know, the fact that we can do this stuff from our houses and connect with people that are, in other parts of the country or in other countries for that matter. You can really accomplish a lot in a Zoom in one of these calls. Although I'm the first one that I love being
to go room. To see people. To,
yeah, the whole
but,
thing.
But so, you know, yeah, I'm doing a lot of stuff. You know, meetings every day and stuff for projects and things. All from here. And what I've noticed is it's just, I've gotten everything done that I need to get done. And I'm not driving around polluting the air, filling up the freeway. Like, in terms of Southern California, it's, you know, you can actually drive. If you, you know, when I go to the grocery store or I took my daughter to Halloween Town, it didn't take 45 minutes to travel 3 miles. And I think that a lot of people are going to be, or even that work might be like, you come in 2 days, you Zoom 3 days. And that might be one way that we sort of give our infrastructure a break.
I'm all for it, really. I mean, is again, as much as I like being out in the world, if I can accomplish something, you know, it would have been great to come to your place and you know, have a cup of coffee in person and check out some of your killer collectibles and, you know,
there's the museum.
The museum. Yep. The garage, I think.
Ford panty drop. That's right. But this is an original Plan 9 from Outer Space Saucer.
But here we are. And so, you know, part of that is acceptance and just being open-minded to the way forward.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting. I don't, you know, some stuff is pretty good. The production company that I'm working with is way down in Santa Monica for one of these projects. I love not having to drive home for 2 fucking hours to get home because I left at 6:30 or 7.
Same. I mean, even for me, certain auditions I've been doing, TV and film stuff, even commercial stuff occasionally, I've got a pretty solid setup in my garage and can make a nice looking tape if needed.
Right.
The challenge, of course, is finding, you know, not being in the room and again having that kind of, there's things that you can't really accomplish by that. But if you get yourself a decent reader, you can make a nice looking little tape. And there's, you know,
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned one of the people that was in Two Headed Dreams is your friend Liberty Larson. And for those of you who don't know Liberty Larson, she comes from the Larson family, which is well-placed in Los Angeles lore. And her family, unless I'm mistaken, founded the Magic Castle. Would
correct.
I be correct?
Right. You would. You certainly would.
And they also now run a thing called Brookledge. And you work at the Magic Castle, which is where you would be working all this Halloween week, I'm assuming, if the world was in session. I attended one of the last Houdini seances at the Magic Castle before the Houdini seance renovation. And you wrote a really interesting article about the Houdini seance that I looked at. Called The Room with Thread in Its Walls by yourself and a guy named Jim Steinmeier. So give people, here's the thing. Seances aren't real. or any professional seance is not real. But there was a time when they were sold as real. The Houdini seance at the Magic Castle is a form of a Disney ride. Very specific Disney ride. Would I be correct in that?
Disneyland in the 60s.
Exactly. 100%. But no one's pretending that you're witnessing something spectral in reality.
There are those few unfortunates that do believe that they are. But for the most part, I would say 95% of the guests that come into that room know that they're going on. Yeah. And I say Disneyland in the 60s because the technology, as you probably remember, of that experience weren't up to speed with, you know, 2020.
Yeah, Imagineering. Well, in the article, one of the things that I read, and I want to get to this, is that in the original design of it, they used garage door openers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Correct.
But let's backtrack. Let's talk about the sort of the origin of seances, and then how it refers to Houdini specifically, and where the Magic Castle stepped in, because it's a really fascinating thing. If you asked me the origin of seances, I would have said, well, they started, cavemen had seances, I guess. Not yeah. true. Or did they?
Well, I mean, you could trace the seance back to, I think Homer in the Odyssey wrote about, some kind of a spiritual gathering by the mortals to contact the departed. And even in Egyptian culture, they were kind of bowing down to the gods, trying to find, knowledge and insight from lost and loved ones. So it does, as far as like the history of people wanting to reach those lost loved ones, that does go back a long way. But I think you can, as far as the word seance, which is a French word for, I think, the word sit, and sit in a group and to do this, where more traditionally people think of a seance where people are sitting down holding hands and we're going to contact Uncle Grandpa Joe or whoever. That really became popularized after the Civil War. So mid-1800s, you've got Civil War's over, or it's coming to an end, and you've got these sisters in upstate New York.
The Fox Sisters.
The Fox Sisters, exactly.
Right.
Who reported hearing these rappings from this mysterious person named Mr. Splitfoot. And this...
Wait, did they know his name? Was it like, hi, Ted Splitfoot here?
By way of spelling out words and rapping and things like that, they were able to determine.
It's very slender, Manny.
Yeah, it's
or as I call him, Jared Kushner.
So this became very quick a fad, a phenomenon where seances were something that people would gather together to contact. Usually someone was lost in the Civil War. Now, this came at a very popular time when you had a lot of people were gone from you had a lot of deaths in the Civil War. So
yeah, that's I would just think
convenient.
It was just a reaction to an unnatural event, which was a giant chunk of the population being murdered.
Right. Meanwhile, people are going, oh, all you need to do is get together a group of people. One person is the quote medium, and we can contact your lost husband or brother or sister, whoever was lost in the war. So gypsies and con artists alike decided that they could take the role of medium to play and start to employ the use of magic effects to become spirit mediums.
Far be it for me to quote Cher, but what you're saying is that gypsies, tramps, and thieves, they came for the people of the town.
You got it. Wow, that was good. So even it, like, and this was
everybody
massive.
Under everybody over 46 left. And nobody.
I got it. But even in the White House, these things like this went. This was like people for the most part believed in this in the mid 1800s. So you had guys,
and this was the birth of the what they would call the spiritualism movement in America.
Exactly. So Mary Todd Lincoln, for example, had a seances plural in the White House to contact her lost son Willie, who passed of typhoid fever, probably from drinking poisonous water that came through the White House. And it was their beloved son. So they actually sat down, Lincoln as well, people believed it. It was this sort of like, there was no reason at that point for people not to believe until they started, people started using common sense and going, oh, these are gypsies and con artists sort of presenting these fake seances and calling themselves seers and soothsayers when in fact they were con artists. So the whistle was blown and it kind of died and it all kind of went away.
How long did it?
That had about a good 10 year run. The first one was about a 10 year run. And then in the 1920s, again, what happens? We got the end of World War I, 1914, 1918, right? So World War I's finished in 18. And 1920, boom, seance has become, again, a massive, another...
Because in addition to World War One, you have Spanish flu.
Right. So people are
dropping like flies.
They're dropping like flies. This time around, we've got a hero to the steps in this picture who was a magician, of course. Many will know his name, Harry Houdini. Now, Houdini had a big interest in spiritualism and really wanted nothing more to believe, particularly when his mother passed, who he was very close with. He really wanted nothing more than to believe in the afterlife and know that there was a way to contact the departed. However, he was also
it's so funny because that is the root of it all is that you just want there to be something else. It's just to be comforted that you can connect with somebody from the quote other side. Yeah,
sure. We all want
it's that. Funny. It's funny. I'm getting this wrong, but Stanley Kubrick, like, said to Stephen King, like, and they weren't fans of each other. You know, The Shining is an incredibly hopeful book because it says that there's something beyond the grave. Like, all these books are hopeful because they say that there is definitely something that comes afterward, which is an interesting take on it.
It's not always great, but there is something. So Houdini was all about kind of wanting to find this truth, and but was smart enough to realize that these, and I say quote, you know, mediums were using magic tricks to fool and con people, good people who were actually mourning their closest relatives and loved ones, and he was going, hey, these people are crooks. You can't do this. Scientific American organization.
It's so funny because when people think Houdini seance, they think of, well, he must have been one of the big proponents of Santa, but he was like the Amazing Randy. He was debunking them.
He was the great debunker. He would go in and sometimes dressed like an older woman, or he would go into these things incognito because he was so massively famous. People would kind of know, you know, that he was. His face was very recognizable.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize.
But he would often go in.
Because Ed Wood would also go in dressed as an older woman.
Yes, he would. Really, yeah. So anyway, there was Houdini kind of, you know, blowing the walls down of these seance rooms and doing a great job at it. And it was amazing. So when Houdini died in 1926, he had a pact with his wife, Bessie. And the pact was, because he died at pretty unexpectedly and very fast. But prior to that, they had this
terrible peritonitis, right?
Yeah. He was slugged in the stomach after performing in Canada on October 30th and was rushed to a hospital in Detroit on Halloween. And I'm telling you this date because for years prior to his death, he'd always predicted he was going to die on Halloween.
Oh, that's interesting. And am I wrong? He got that right. Am I wrong in thinking he famously would tell people, come and punch me in the stomach, because he had such strong abdominal muscles? But somebody, from what I understand, I could be completely wrong. A guy didn't warn him, and he just punched him in the stomach.
Exactly.
He didn't have time to tense up his muscles, and he burst his appendix.
Correct. The backstory on that was he was on tour. He's 52 at this point. He was famous since 1900. So he's been famous for 25 years. He's the Madonna. I don't know. Pick your popular cultural icon, but he's well into his fame. He's doing a tour, and after the show, he gets into a robe and he's doing a interview with a college student for a newspaper. And the college student brought along a buddy who said, hey, I heard you can take a blow to the stomach at any time. Houdini answered, yeah, I can, without knowing, you know, may I, can I, I'm going to, and literally just hauled off and threw a blow to the stomach. And Houdini went down for a second, but you got to remember, this guy was holding his breath for periods of time in a water torture cell each night. He was doing all kinds of escapes and very physical feats. He was always hurting himself. So he could, like, this is a guy that could handle you know, right. a torn rotator cuff or a sprained wrist or whatever. Right. This is a guy who was living with, you know, probably a lot of pain. And so endured it that night. The next morning he woke up and he's like, I'm not doing well. And actually it was very rare for him to say, I need to go to a doctor. Meanwhile, the reason he needed to go is because he was bleeding to death inside. He was like massive hemorrhaging inside. So they got him down to a hospital in Detroit, and he died on Halloween, which is weird because for a guy who wanted to believe in you know, trippy and things like the afterlife, to predict his own death was it's just a weird.
Yeah, it is.
Call it a coincidence or I don't know.
You got to give it to him.
There's something, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a 1 in 365, right? So it's like it's a weird – the odds are not very unlikely that was going to happen. Anyway, back to the pact that he had with Bessie was like –
and that's 1926.
1926, Halloween 1926. So he and Bessie have this pact. Hey, look. Whoever dies first, the other conducts a seance every year on the person on the death date of that person for 10 years. That's the deal. And then go on with your life. Let's just try it. 10 years, right. Once a year. So Bessie, of course, honored, you know, the pact. And they had a couple of code words. Should the other person come back, that this person would chime in with there was two words, at least that I'm aware of. And that would be the word. And boy, for 10 years, Bessie tried. And the 10th and final seance took place on the roof of the Knickerbocker Hotel in Hollywood. So, in other words, for the first 9 years, nothing happened. It was just a wash each year. But the 10th one was going to be the last one. It was a biggie. Bessie was responsible for keeping his name in the paper. She was definitely like, it was a big deal. It was recorded. It's Halloween 1936, roof of the Knickerbocker Hotel. Press is going crazy for it. It's being broadcast nationally.
Wow, so it's a big deal.
Yep. You got bleacher seating. 300 people are the mayor of Hollywood's there. You mentioned, we talked a little bit about Liberty Larson earlier, one of my dear friends and performing friends who's the great-granddaughter of the founders of Magic Castle and the Academy of Magical Arts. Well, her great-grandfather was at this seance, William Larson Sr. This guy had a front row seat, was watching this all take place. So it was a very public, very strange seance. And the guy that conducted it was this guy, Dr. Edward Saint, who was Bessie's – well, some say they were engaged. It's possible they were even married. But he was also the spirit medium. Little backstory, also a carnival worker. So, you know,
a fine tradition.
They called him Dr. Edward Saint. Whether he was a real doctor, we don't really know. But so let's just say probably another con artist from show business. And he conducted this.
A huckster.
Big time.
Right.
So for an hour he tries and nothing happens. And people are getting up to leave and they're walking back into the Knickerbocker Hotel. And then out of the blue, and we have a clear October sky. Halloween in 1936 was a warm October, kind of like we're having now. But for some reason that night, a thundercloud by people that were there, this is on record, this thundercloud from a distance comes in and hovers over the roof of the Knickerbocker and showers for a minute. So again, weird thing. I'm a skeptic. Yep. I'm not a believer, but you explain that, you know, like there's certain things I find, are trippy and unusual. And I like to kind of cock my head and wonder a little bit myself.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, I hope it's true. You know, it's like, I don't want to debunk that. I want it to be something. If I was going to debunk it, I would start by hitching up my pants, sniffing, and then going, actually, and then I'd be off and running.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, look, I wouldn't be interested in all this stuff if there wasn't some small
part. And the Knickerbocker's still there.
Knickerbocker's still there. Yeah, still there. And looks...
It's down by MacArthur Park, isn't it?
No, the Knickerbocker is about 4 blocks from the Magic Castle. You're thinking of the Park Plaza Hotel, I think, which is by MacArthur Park. But the Knickerbocker...
So it's closer to the Roosevelt.
Correct. It's the Knickerbocker is one of the few hotels that if you're driving on the 101 freeway south, you would see the big neon sign on the roof, Knickerbocker right. Hotel. It's right there. It's literally walking near Hollywood and Vine.
Right.
So that's the 10th and final Lumiere seance. Bessie goes on and says, 10 years is long enough to wait for any man. I'm moving on. And went on to live for another, dozen or so years. So that was that
with
was
the same dude, with the guy that ran the
with Dr. Edward Saint. Yeah, they stayed very close, and to their credit, they went on to preserve Houdini's name and keep him in the papers, and really made it their kind of crusade in life to keep his name alive. So much that when in the 1980s, when Madonna became entered the spotlight. She said, I want to have a career like Harry Houdini because all these years after he died and he was gone physically from the world, people would still know the name Houdini. They didn't know what he did necessarily, sure. But they knew that he was someone special in his sort of chosen.
Oh yeah. Yeah, field. Definitely. He was, it was like Sammy, Madonna, Houdini.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. I mean, so she did. So I think Bessie was very successful in preserving his name and keeping it alive in pop culture.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
And there are, what's interesting is the more things change, the more they stay the same. There are legion of people that will purportedly perform a seance and put you in touch with somebody from the great beyond that'll do it with a straight face and convince you that it's real. One of my favorite 40s noirs based on a great book is Nightmare Alley, which is all about that scam that ran in the 30s and 40s.
Yep. Beautiful. One of my favorite movies for sure.
Yeah. Hill Geek.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. My mom was really into that stuff. Yeah.
So was she a believer? Did she? Yeah, for sure.
Right. Well, we used to have seances. We had a duplex and my aunt lived in the duplex next door. So we would have neighborhood kids. We'd have the other kids in our neighborhood over for a seance in what we would call the back hall, the back room. And then one of us would go into my aunt's house and would be on the other side of the wall and we'd bang a bucket against the wall because it sounded like a heartbeat.
Yeah, right.
So we had a lot of good fun doing that. But we didn't take money from anybody, which means it was legal.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is there's still people today that are out there and there's a massive audience for these crooks. And I find it horrifying. And that's not why I'm fascinated by it at all. I find that
any kind of sad and depressing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then there's the entertainment version of it, which is great, which is, so, Liberty's grandfather is at this, seance in 1936.
Her great grandfather. Yes.
Her great grandfather. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who founded the Magic Castle?
Well, his son. So, William Larson Sr.,
Wouldn't it be weird if a guy named William Larson had a son and named him William Larson Sr. just to screw people up?
That would be pretty good.
A lifetime of explaining.
Well, his son.
Hi, I'm Bill. I am Bill, and here's my baby, Bill Sr.
We call him Gladys, though. William Larson Sr. had this idea to found the Academy of Magical Arts, which was a way to bring magicians together to share secrets and have a sort of academy and ultimately have a clubhouse somewhere where they could meet and enjoy the camaraderie of magic as an art form.
Right. And there is this beautiful building up above, above Franklin in yep. Hollywood, right up the street from Hollywood and Vine.
Yep.
And it was a boarding house up until the 50s?
Yep. Exactly.
Can you imagine living there?
Well, it wasn't a board it was of course it was a mansion. It started off right. as a it was built as a um a French chateau inspired mansion right there in Franklin, and a guy named Roland B. Lane had it built 1908.
Sure.
And he owned half the banks.
Well, sure, Roland Lane.
Roland Lane. Well, hey, he was a real player pre-Hollywood, meaning it was when Hollywood was known for banks and orange groves.
Right.
That was the primary source of commerce at that time. Right. So you have this guy who kind of owns, you know, a chunk of Hollywood, and he passes on, and that does become a boarding house. Some say it was a brothel, even. Like, there's even rumors of that. And then 1959 comes around. It's a dilapidated boarding house. And these two brothers who are writing for a show called Truth or Consequences, right?
Sure, Hollywood and Highland.
They're looking down on this dilapidated house, and they go, hey, maybe that's the place where Dad wanted us to have the Magic Club. This is a true story. It sounds unbelievable. But they went on a hunch. They went and knocked on the door, and they said, hey, we wanted to know if there's any way we could take over the lease on this place and or maybe buy it. I don't know. Make some deal and turn this into this Academy of Magical Arts, a place for magicians to come, and it'd be a private club for magicians and their guests. And the owner of the property, you know, I think they were probably fed up with running this, you know, dilapidated boarding house, said, yeah, why not? So on a handshake deal, rented, and to this day continues to rent the Magic Castle to the Academy of Magical Arts. And 4 years later, 1963, January 2nd, I think was the date, Magic Castle opens its doors, and it becomes a massive hit in the magic world. Everybody in magic wants to go there. They want to be there. They want to perform there. It is the essential be-all, end-all clubhouse worldwide for magic. And it's so popular that people are moving here from different countries, and they're coming in.
Oh, really? Just to
be a part of it. Yeah. And it is each year it becomes increasingly popular, and it is the place to be. If you love magic and magic is your, you know, quote, a magician, this is where you want to go.
And it never stopped.
To the day of March, whatever, whenever COVID.
March 2020.
You know, yeah, March 2020. It was seven nights a week, close-up stage, parlor magic. It was lectures. I mean, anything related to magic, you were in. So 5 years into the
COVID. And it will absolutely reopen when the world reopens.
I want to think that's true. Yeah. 5 years into the club's existence, Houdini Seance Room opens because when the club opened, there just a small portion of the house was used as the Magic Castle, and now it's 30,000 square feet on the inside. So it's massive structure, and they've expanded and blown some of the walls out.
And if you've never been there, what I would describe it's basically the Haunted Mansion from Disney World, but you can walk around and there are shows and bars and there's food.
Correct.
but it looks like that. And it's the thing that blew me away, which I didn't realize, you know, I grew up as a kid in Massachusetts watching The Tonight Show, and behind Johnny Carson was a painting of the valley. You know, just he would sit at his desk and there was a painting behind him of the street grid of the valley. And I would always think, like in high school, watching it, like, oh, that's where I want to live. That's where I want to live. And that painting is behind the bar at the Magic Castle. And I was looking at it like, that's the actual painting. And like that piece of fabric or whatever it is, that captured my imagination as a teenager. And it's right there. That's the thing that just – and Johnny Carson was a big supporter of the Magic Castle. He was an amateur magician.
Yeah, apparently he was really good. He would have magicians from the Magic Castle come hang out at his place on weekends when he wasn't filming the show, and they would jam. He loved coin tricks and card tricks. He was a close-up guy. But as a teenager, I think that was his first the first sort of art form that he was attracted to. And there's great photos of him when, you know, we all know him as the white-haired chain-smoking Carson, but he was a kind of a, you know, coiffed teenaged, like all American sure. looking kid, like holding some, you know, linking rings up. And
was it the Carsoni? Was that what it was?
Carsoni, exactly. Yeah. 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 I mean, as Steve Martin was very, very similar, very similar background. Anyway, back to the seance room. So in 1969, as they're expanding the Magic Castle, they decide, hey, you know what? Let's recreate that 10th and final Houdini seance right here. And there's a seance that we have a room to build a seance chamber. And it was a Victorian style seance where we'd get 13 guests in the room and a medium would sort of guide you through the night and tell you the history of Houdini. So, sort of like I just did, but you know, in a slightly in a fascinating sort of layered way. And then we bring the lights down and we actually try to summon the spirit of Houdini. And throughout a 45-minute performance, you would kind of get to experience, you know, a shaking tambourine in the dark, or a trumpet that's blown, or voices that come from you know, disembodied.
Table moves.
Tables that move, and garage door openers and things that we've sort of, you know, talked about a little bit. So it was a very, like, as we've said, Disneyland in the 60s version of what a spooky seance might have been like.
Now, that brings to mind another element of a very commercialized element of spiritualism, the Ouija board, which I did not know until only recently. That name is owned by Parker Brothers. So if you want to make your own Ouija board, you can't call it a Ouija board. It has to be a spirit board.
Spirit board. Yes, yeah. That's exactly right. Yep.
But
there's some great looking spirit boards, but I've been at a Parker Brothers spirit board on occasions with people that believe in really strange. There's been some pretty interesting outcomes from being there.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I always, as a skeptic and a non-believer, I always say to my audiences, you know, and if you believe, you will receive. And that's the truth of it. You know, it's like
Johnny Cochran also said that, I believe.
But you know, it's like, I don't get scared of things until I'm in a dark room or a dark alley all by myself on a Friday night. You know, it's like, my mind will play tricks on me and I'll start seeing and hearing things that aren't necessarily there. So that's, I think, very true for people that enter the seance room, is that they really want to have an experience. They want to believe. So they do.
Yeah, that's 100%. I wanted to take this opportunity to give a free plug. You'll love this too. You know, one of the best things about this podcast and you know, Instagram and things like that, is that you get to meet and connect with people that you don't know, and then, you know, that share similar interests. And I wanted to give a plug to somebody, a really brilliant artist that I follow on Instagram named Jeff Braun, JeffBrawn. If you go to jeffbrawn.com, or it might be Jeff Braun Artist, but you can Google it and find it, JeffBrawn. He makes... he's made a Criswell spirit board.
Whoa.
Criswell Ouija board and the spiritual organization of Rachel, Kansas, a Ghost and Mr. Chicken spirit board.
My God.
Yeah. And these are functioning spirit boards with working planchettes. And he's also the king of
the images onto the board, or does like a portrait.
Designed the board. He designed the board and printed the board. God. And he also, you know, he makes this, I'm wearing a John Candy, Dr. Tongue's 3D House of Stewardesses t-shirt, courtesy of Jeff Braun. Yeah. He's amazing. You got to check him out, Jeff Braun. And for you, or if you're listening to this podcast, I'm not getting any money from this. He's just awesome. You should check out his story. He has so many great things. And yeah, and I love the fact that I live in a time where people make Ghost and Mr. Chicken spirit boards. God damn it. It's going to be framed and hang on the hall of, it's going to be framed and hang on my office wall as soon as I get it.
Love it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we touched on this earlier. Like, you weren't in, when you were in Possum Dixon, you weren't into magic. Like, you weren't a student of this all your life. You came to this later.
I fell into all of this in my mid-20s, you know, accidentally learning a magic trick and then having the weird luck of having a pass to go to the Magic Castle with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and just walking in the Magic Castle and falling in love with the subculture.
Yeah, and that's the perfect word for it, too.
Subculture?
Yeah. It's just a culture.
Yeah.
A culture within a culture within a culture.
It just reminded me, you know, everything that I loved about kind of discovering music as a young kid, it had all those same elements. I didn't know anything, and I wanted to know everything. And a large part of that was the Houdini seance room, because it's the most mysterious room in the Magic Castle. It's kind of the club within the club. It's not like you can just... You don't go to the Magic Castle as a guest and then just wander in the seance room and get treated to a seance. Let's just call it an added attraction. There's usually a dinner involved around it, and there's a certain protocol.
Yeah, because I'd been there a couple times without never being privy to the seance.
Right. You wouldn't necessarily know about it until somebody said, "Hey, do you know about the Houdini seance room and all that?" So it's really this very special room. And as I became immersed in that milieu of that sort of whole community, Houdini seance room being part of it and part of magic's history, I was drawn right to it. It was kind of like, wow, well, what is spiritualism? What is a seance? And really became so fascinated with it that over the years I attended a handful of the seances and got into certain forms of spooky kinds of magic tricks and spirit magic, as it's known in the magic world. And then 10 years ago, I had the good fortune of filling in for the medium who had been doing the seances since, 1983 or something. Done like 3,000 seances.
And who was that?
Leo Koska is his name. And he, very interesting backstory with him, he had delivered papers to the Lane Mansion in the 50s. Like, his history in Hollywood is insane and really quite cool. And lifelong magician. And so he's been doing these seances. He's done all these seances, but he never had a backup medium and had to take some time off. And there I was, and I came in and kind of quickly learned the ropes and found my own way to present the Houdini seance. So for 10 years, I've been doing these. I've done hundreds of them. And it's a world. I mean, as you and I have discussed many times, it's a complete rabbit
hole. I love it.
You never learn it all. There's crazy. There's always one more medium you've never heard of, and there's one little factoid, and there's so many books and literature around this past that it just becomes an obsession, like collecting records or horror films.
Exactly.
Or, you know.
Yeah, and
like
it's a beautiful place to go. And you know, there's something about the Magic Castle that when I was a young punk, I always sneered at. And now it's one of the things about it I love is that you have to dress up.
Exactly. Yeah, the protocol. Coat and tie for men, cocktail attire for ladies. No jeans or sneakers. You know,
And you know, when I was in my early 20s and I was living here and I was a punky stand-up, it's so stupid.
Right. You
know, it's like, but now it's like, no, it's so great.
Thank God.
It really is like a time. It is like a time machine, you know, everyone. And I miss that. I like that. And this is, you know, this is just sort of a going down a rabbit hole. But I remember when Reagan was lying in state at the Reagan Library and people were lining up to pay their respects to him. And there were people in like shorts, flip flops and Hawaiian shirts just to walk up to it's like, or see people on the plane, just put some fucking clothes on. I'm not conservative. I'm not a conservative person. I'm a raging liberal. But put on some clothes. It's not going to kill you.
Agreed.
It's not going to kill you.
I think the idea behind that was that you get dressed up and you kind of look your best. You might want to lean towards acting your best. Now, of course, there are exceptions to the rules.
But that's true.
Right?
But that's true. Steve Martin always used to say a thing that he always wanted to dress better than the audience was dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just set a tone, you know? Yep. And sure. I'm not of that generation, but I don't go on stage in my street clothes. Even if they look like street clothes, they're not.
Right.
I wear this on stage. I don't wear this on, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's something to make your choice, but as a performer, consider it, think about, you know, it's something you should have a fully formed thought, you know, based on some opinion about how you want to be perceived. But yeah, at the Magic Castle, it adds the whole decorum is like you go in and everyone's dressed up. They want to have a good time. Everyone's kind of looking, maybe hopefully feeling their best because they've gone to the trouble. And so it adds to this whole,
they've got some booze in them,
some food. I mean, the whole thing is an experience. And, I just think it overall elevates, the art form. You know, there's people, it's funny, there's magicians who I've known for years and years, and I've always seen them at the Magic Castle, and they're always kind of suited up and all that jazz. And then I might bump into them at, I don't know, say Paquito Moss, and I'm like, wait a second. And they're wearing the flip-flops and the Hawaiian shirt and the cargo shorts, and you're like, oh my God.
I don't recognize it.
I don't. Yeah, it's almost like something you don't want to see.
It's like when you see a porn star at Vaughn's, but you don't recognize them because they're dressed.
Exactly.
It's like, I know that. I was at Trader Joe's in Studio City, and I'm with my wife at the time. I was like, who is that?
How do I?
Ron. Right. Well, right, you see Ron Jeremy, you think he's the Wolfman. Although you don't see him anymore.
No.
And so that must have been a tremendous honor to suddenly find yourself performing the Houdini Seance at this legendary place.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Did you feel like, okay, I made it. I did it.
To a degree, I did. I did feel like I had sort of, it was one of those, it was a milestone. Like, yep, this is something that, boy, when I walked to the Magic Castle to perform in any of the showrooms was like, oh, those people that do that are on, they're up here. I'm somewhere down here. Those people are on this, operating on some other level that is amazing. And one day I would, you know, take a hit of my imaginary bong and want to dream of that. And then slowly did do that. But doing the seances was even a higher honor because so few people had sort of done them. And there's it's a pretty detailed script, and it's a world, it's something you have to really love to want to learn about and share that knowledge.
And to be a part of. Yeah.
Yeah. And so much that I developed some magic effects, to fit the room and even ended up marketing, one of those effects that became very popular among magicians to perform. And so it was really something that I became extremely immersed, and it was an honor the whole time. And it's led to, you know, like, you'd mentioned you'd read my article, I'd written an article came out in this month's, Genie magazine about the history of the room. So you just like,
we'll put a link up to the article on the Patreon page.
Please do. Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point is, it paid off artistically. And it's one of those things that it defines me as, I guess I hate the word artist, but something, whatever version of that, people would go, they think of seances and they might,
sure,
by way of the internet, find their way to the Zabrecki character, this kind of character that I perform as when I'm doing it.
And that's the last thing I want to talk about, that I'm so envious of magicians because you have a character that you perform. You're Rob Zabrecki, and then you perform as Zabrecki. And it's an element of you, but it's a completely three-dimensional different persona. And magicians get to do that. I was always, and in the 80s, a lot of comedians did that. Like, you know, well, people would think that Stephen Wright was performing as a character. He really wasn't. That's really Stephen. but I was always envious, especially like Paul, in creating Pee Wee, that Paul Rubens, that you create this three-dimensional character that is your performing life and you're totally separate of it.
Yeah.
And I was always so envious of that, because comedians by and large, the whole point is to not be a character. The whole point is to kind of be who you are.
Right.
If you do the kind of stand-up comedy that I aspire to do. When I was in, when I was traveling around doing on the road in the 80s all the time, I would always see, they have the wall of the people that perform, and a lot of them are still there. I'm there in many haircuts over the years, but you'd always see Max Maven.
Mm-hmm.
Max Maven was always performing in comedy clubs, but he was also at the Magic Castle.
Right.
Who is Max Maven?
Well, Max Maven is a Boston-based magician.
I had no idea he's from Boston.
Yep, who up until the late 70s was known as Phil Goldstein, and made a major transformation in his life, and literally, and I mean literally to the point of getting his license. He doesn't have a driver's license, but his US ID changed to Max Maven. He's legally Max Maven. And he severed ties with his former self to become this
fully
developed. Yeah, that's I think if you called him Phil, he wouldn't respond.
By the way, yeah. I had no idea. Is he still around?
He is. He is still Max Maven.
Are there any little Mavens at home?
There are not. He is one of one. But I greatly admire, respect Max for so many reasons. But the fact that he's so committed to that character and that world that he's created, not to mention the thousands of effects he's contributed to the magic
world. Yeah, no, he's a big deal in that world.
A historian and a beautiful, beautiful writer, an amazing storyteller, and just one of my favorite people. He's a wonderful person. And again, an inspiration when I was putting together the Zabrecki character, which I created not because I felt like it was some great idea to do that, but I was scared to perform as, oh, here's this guy that was in a band for 10 years. Now he's going to do magic. Like that kind of didn't add up. But to hide behind a visage, like I realized that I have kind of a spooky looking face. For better or worse.
I wouldn't say spooky.
Some call it the gaunt visage of Zabrecki.
The gaunt visage.
Yeah. And so I realized that, like, okay, I could take my love of horror films and silent films, right, and experimental music and all these things that I'm kind of in love with, and weave them into this character that if I fully form
there's
this
a,
thing,
there's a,
I can,
there's
I can
a hide. Ian Curtis, the great Curtisini would be
Curtisini. Yeah. Well,
yeah,
thank
no,
you.
There's a Norman. Nice. Yeah. There's a Norman. Well, here's the interesting thing. Yeah. I mean, it's not you. It's a perfect distillation of kind of like the aspect of your personality that works well in that world. It fits that world really well. It's, if you showed me, if I didn't know you and you showed me, you got to go see a magician, I'd look at who, and I'd tell you, oh no, well, that's the one I want to see. There's an element of, if you get it, you'll get it.
Yeah.
That I like. And what's interesting is when I was in Boston doing comedy in the 80s, there was a comedian who had a not dissimilar approach in his character. That comedian now works at the Magic Castle in a completely different character, Phil Van T.
Or as we know him, El Ropo.
El Ropo. But El Ropo, when he was a comedian in Boston, was Phil Van T, and he was like Zabrecki telling jokes.
Right. I've had many conversations with him. Phil's great. And he was, I think.
I love Phil so much. He's such a lovely man. And he's about 12 feet tall.
He is quite tall. And when you put on that, his 10 gallon, cowboy hat.
It's so not,
he's 13
it's so not who I know. It's the last time I think the last time I was at the Magic Castle, I was there with Bobcat and he was with his girlfriend and I was with my girlfriend, or as we call them, Wilma and Betty. And, we all went and we both saw Phil. We both know Phil from Boston, but he's dressed like Tom Mix.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, no, you're dressed like Phil. Phil's dressed like somebody else.
Which stands to reason, in 20 years, I might look like Tom Mix.
Well, I get you and David Lovering and other people, like you're a punk musician and then you go into magic. And I completely get that evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Yeah.
It's not dissimilar than comedian to writer. It's not dissimilar at all. It's like, yeah, this is the next step when you want to do something else.
Well, performing
using
arts,
similar yeah. muscles, using the yeah. same muscles in a different way.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. That's
that all makes sense.
That's true. Yeah. Good. I'm glad, you know, and for Phil, he changed gears and yeah, went from stand-up comedy where he's described as that character that he would perform at in Boston in the 80s was like a serial killer doing stand-up. That was kind of his.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. And he was, and he was imposing and tall and dark, and he dressed in a black suit. I really loved him. In his 8x10, he was just standing there glaring. But if you look very closely, you see that he's holding a pair of scissors.
Oh, wow.
But it's just down by his side. Like, it wasn't featured at all. It was very subtle. And I always admired. I love Phil so much. But I do, you know, like, I love the idea of that complete building a character and then building a world. And that's, you know, that's the, all the people that I love to watch, and Pee-wee Herman is a great example. It's like, yeah, you build this character, then you build this world around it. And it all fits together.
Yeah. I mean, the beauty of that is in magic, unlike other art forms, you have complete control over the end product. You get to write, produce, direct, and act. If you're an actor acting in a movie, you it's unlikely you're going to pick the soundtrack and the fonts that they put up on the credits and all that jazz. Right. Any other actors that you work with. In magic, you can really create a thing. Like stand-up comedy, I would imagine it's very similar, where you get to create everything the way you look, kind of, you know, all of it. And the sound cues, of course, like there's a million different things that keep me really attracted to magic. And the control of that is a large component that I can put all these creative attributes.
That's what I loved about being a part of Two Headed Dreams was a way to kind of become a part of that level of showmanship and thought. And it was great. And if people who hear this, want to know when the next one is or try to see the other one, where do they go? Where are you online?
I think Instagram is probably my most. I probably check in there the most. And whenever I'm I'm doing something, I tend to put out. So at Rob Zabrecki is the handle.
It's RobZabrecky. This has been so great. Thank you so much. Now, do you have what are your Halloween plans?
I don't. There was some talk about doing another Two-Headed Dreams closer to Halloween, but we decided to push a little bit. So I really don't know. I have a little installation going in my front yard. It's nothing too exciting.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, for me,
I will be repositioning a skeleton within 30 minutes of ending this conversation.
Same. But around here, you know, the one other thing I'll add is I have a little seance show that I have online. And a couple of years ago, when I was trying to create content,
this is the other side.
Yeah, the other side with Zabrecki. I was trying to create content for the character to live not in the ephemeral world that we've talked about where you're on stage and there's, you know, a live audience, but in the world of YouTube and things like that. So I created this show called Other Side with Zabrecki, and there's a YouTube channel dedicated to there's 12 episodes of the show, and the 13th will air on Halloween. And the premise of the show is quite simple. I invite guests to come on and they get to contact a spirit of their choice. That's the show, and I've had some great guests. My first season was taped 2 years ago. I probably won't do it anymore. Just when I met you, we had just wrapped shooting all of my season. I thought, boy, this would have been like my ideal guest, because it's a comedy seance, and they're not meant to be taken serious. For example, Jack Black was a guest, and he contacted Kurt Cobain. So, and it's in no seriousness at all. It's all done.
Sure.
In
yeah, that's perfect.
They come from the bowels of hell, a transformed race of walking dead, zombies guided by a master plan for complete domination of the earth. Plan 9 from outer space. Starring the most frightmarish cast ever, Bela Lugosi,
the seductive Vampira, and Tor Johnson as the Walking Dead.
Turn off your electro gun! No! No! Stop him, Dennis!
I can't get it, it's jammed!
Stop him, you fool!
Bullets bounce off their bodies. Rockets, missiles, jets cannot stop their death ship. What earthly power can stop this terror? For a glimpse of things to come, see this blast of screen suspense. For it could be happening right now.
They're true tales from Weirdsville. Tales from Weirdsville. And they're true.
Can your heart stand the shocking fact?
It was December of 1847, and John and Margaret Fox were moving into a new home in beautiful Hydesville, New York. Fun fact, Hydesville no longer exists. It's now a part of Arcadia, New York, near Newark. And with John and Margaret Fox were two of their three daughters, Maggie, 14, and Kate, 11. Their oldest daughter, Leah, was already married and living with her husband upstate in Rochester, New York. Now, from the start, the Fox house was noisy. Not the household, not the kids, the house itself. It creaked, it popped, it groaned. Late at night, there were knocks and bangs. On the night of March 31st, 1848, the night before April Fool's Day, and not 4 months after they had moved in, the knocks took on a personality. Maggie and Kate began talking to whoever or whatever was making the noise. They asked for this spirit to rap out their ages, 11 and 14. 25 knocks later, the Fox family sat frozen in their chairs. Maggie and Kate, through a series of yes or no questions, communicated with this spirit, who they called Mr. Splitfoot, which was a nickname for the devil. Later, the girls claimed the spirit was that of a thief named Charles Rosna, who was supposedly murdered in the house 5 years earlier. Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, wrote an article about the girls. They would grow to become that famous, where he reported that the Fox's neighbors dug around their basement and discovered human bones. The reality is there was never a reported missing person named Charles Rosna. But you know, details, details. Now, Hydesville was a small town. It wasn't even a town, it was a township. And word soon got out about the haunted house that the Fox family lived in, and their two remarkable little girls who seemed capable of communicating with spirits from beyond the grave. Word finally reached Rochester, New York, where the oldest daughter, Leah, lived. Leah left Rochester and headed to Hydesville. By the time she got there, the family had sold their new home at a loss and moved. Unfortunately for the Foxes, as Maggie and Kate were somewhat famous by now, the crowds followed them to their new home. Leah arrived and was somewhat suspicious. Mr. Splitfoot followed them? How the what? So Leah got an idea and she separated the girls. She took Kate with her back to Rochester and left Maggie back in Hydesville with her parents. Well, Mr. Splitfoot followed Kate. But a new spirit started talking to Maggie. Now Leah was no fool. She brought Maggie up to Rochester as well and put her two younger sisters to work. Leah arranged for gatherings in her living room where people would pay money to watch her sisters contact the spirit world. Maggie and Kate refined their communications techniques, developing a more sophisticated system of communicating with the spirit world via knocks that even involved using the alphabet. At first, they were called sittings and spirit circles. They came to be known as seances. Because of this, 1848 became known as the birth of the spiritualist movement in America, and Rochester, New York became known as its center. Now, you have to realize this was 1848. We were living without the benefits of modern science and modern medicine. Life was short and brutal. Everybody knew a lot of dead people. And the Fox sisters provided a small window into the world beyond the grave, a brief text exchange with the great beyond. And business was booming, with people traveling from all over to speak to their dearly departed through the magical, mystical Fox sisters. After a few months, tired of watching her sisters get all the glory, Leah joined the act. Not communicating by a series of knocks, but by putting herself into a trance and letting the spirits talk to her. Soon they hired a manager and booked themselves into the largest theater in Rochester, the Corinthian Hall, performing a lecture on communicating with the spirit world. Now, of course, the Fox sisters, even back then, were suspected of fraud. So their managers hired professional skeptics and debunkers to witness their readings and debunk them. To be skeptical. They tried and failed to find any tricks involved. Now, of course, this was all part of the hype. And the show was a hit. The girls took it on the road and slowly began expanding it. Soon, spirits weren't just knocking. They were lifting tables. They were pulling people's hair. And then, hey, what do you know? Other people started becoming spiritualists, too. By 1852, tens of thousands of people claimed to believe in spiritualism. Now, remember, it wasn't demonic. Quite the contrary. The bulk of the Fox sisters' early fandom in Rochester was composed of Quakers. Spiritualists merely confirmed the belief that there was a life beyond this one. But still, the skeptics persisted. In 1851, Reverend C. Chauncey Burr, how's that for a name, wrote an article for the New York Tribune about the Fox sisters, in which he revealed their trick. His theory was backed up by a similar investigation by three investigators from the University of Buffalo. They had the Fox sisters perform a seance while sitting on a couch with pillows under their feet. There was no communication from beyond the grave in this instance. Why? Because it was believed, correctly, that the raps and knocks and bangs emanating from beyond the infinite were actually emanating from the Fox sisters' shoes. The Fox sisters, for some reason, had the ability to crack their toes the way that other people crack their knuckles. But this didn't really affect the Fox sisters' business, nor the greater spiritualist movement, because people wanted to believe. People want to believe crazy stuff, and they don't let the facts get in their way. Look around. Also, the Civil War happened in 1861, killing an estimated 750,000 Americans over a four-year period. So again, everybody knew a lot of dead people, and they wanted to talk to them. In 1852, Maggie married Elijah Kane, who was a famous Arctic explorer. Kane was convinced that the seances were fraud. Maggie didn't even tell her secret to her husband. It was, after all, the family business. But Elijah Kane tried to pull her away from the seance business, and he succeeded to a degree. He got her to convert to Roman Catholicism. You know, you're not going to find anybody running a scam there. But Maggie was now deep in the thrall of the Roman Catholic Church and booze, and that goes together more often than you'd think. As was her sister Kate, at least the booze part. Leah was still pressuring them to toe the line and stop drinking and get their shit together. But anyone who has ever had that argument with a family member can tell you how successful those conversations usually are. Maggie began to believe that her, quote, powers were evil, or as she said at the time, diabolical. And she went on tour to officially debunk the family's act, showing audiences how she and her sister would crack their toes and their ankles, and how that accounted for their communication with the spirit world. In an article in the New York Observer in 1888, Maggie explained that one of the key ingredients to a seance was the simple fact that people want to believe, and therefore take part in it. And I quote, "Mrs. Underhill, her sister Leah, my eldest sister, took Katie and me to Rochester. There it was that we discovered a new way to make the wraps. My sister Katie was the first to observe that by swishing her fingers, she could produce certain noises with her knuckles and joints, and that the same effect could be made with the toes. Finding that we could make wraps with our feet, first with one foot and then with both, we practiced until we could do this easily, when the room was dark. Like most perplexing things when made clear, it's astonishing how easily it is done. The wrapping is simply the result of perfect control of the muscles of the leg, below the knee, which govern the tendons of the foot and allow the action of the toe and ankle bones that are not commonly known. Such perfect control is only possible when the child is taken at an early age and carefully and continually taught to practice the muscles, which grow stiffer in later years. This, then, is the simplest explanation of the whole method of the knocks and wraps." Maggie soon learned, however, that debunking spiritualism didn't pay as well as spiritualism, and published a full recantation of her debunking, trying vainly to get back into the family business. But her return never quite took hold. Leah, by now, was out of the group, having married a banker. Maggie and Kate both ended up in New York City. Maggie did end up okay. She married a guy with money. Kate, deep into alcoholism, ended up destitute, living in a tenement house. Maggie and Kate, in their later years, both came around to fully denouncing spiritualism. In another interview in the New York World, Maggie said, "Did I have been chiefly instrumental in perpetuating the fraud of spiritualism upon a too confiding public? Most of you doubtless know. The greatest sorrow in my life has been that this is true, and though it has come late in my day, I am now prepared to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God. I am here as one of the founders of spiritualism to denounce it as an absolute falsehood from beginning to end, as the flimsiest of superstitions, the most wicked blasphemy known to the world." And her sister Kate said, "I regard spiritualism as one of the greatest curses that the world has ever known." Oh, Kate, you died too soon. But of course, none of that matters when your audience wants to believe.
You are sleeping. You do not want to believe. You are sleeping.
Let me take this opportunity to thank MyBookie for supporting the Dana Gould Hour podcast. Winning season returns at MyBookie, and winning season means doubling your first deposit. It also means Survivor, Super Contests, and Squares. Now, I would only recommend a service to my listeners that's been good to me. That's why MyBookie is always the right play. You bet, you win, they pay. I didn't know anything about MyBookie. I actually was not a giant sports nut until only recently. And I was talking to my brother on the phone, and my brother does it. And he walked me through signing up. It's quite easy. You go to MyBookie.com. Now we play against each other. Sometimes I bet with him. Usually I bet against him, if only for the joy of betting against him. But at MyBookie, winning season means hitting all your parlays and props with your feet up. Trounce their rivals. So rejoice. It's time to celebrate the NFL season. What I like about MyBookie is that you invest in your own intuition. You bet on yourself. Use the promo code Dana and double your first deposit. New players get up to $1,000 in free play, designed to add more excitement to the sports you love and the games you bet. Don't bet more than you're willing to lose. But at MyBookie, every play you want to make is waiting for you. And use the promo code Dana to double your first deposit at MyBookie.
every one of you watching this screen, look out. Because soon, very soon, the most horrifying monster menace ever conceived will be oozing into this theater. Two teenagers see it first, like a falling star from outer space.
Boy, that was close. Hey, come on, I want to see if I can find it.
It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
This town is in danger.
How can it be stopped? Mob hysteria sweeps one city. Before long, the nation, and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob.
Starring Steve McQueen and a cast of exciting young people.
Into this house came the monsters of slaughter.
Oh my God!
With some of the most hideous tortures and heinous crimes ever shown on the motion picture screen. The Ghastly Ones.
The Ghastly Ones, also known as Blood Rites, came out in 1968. It is a gory, let's call it, extremely low budget, historically set slasher film. It was the first color film by a guy named Andrew Milligan. Andrew Milligan made 27 movies between 1965 and 1988. He was a controversial figure. Oh, Andy had his flaws. He had his flaws. And he had his fans. And he had a lot of people who are fascinated by his career in a look at that cool car wreck kind of way. And yet, Andy Milligan was driven. He had a story to tell. Nobody makes 27 movies because they have nothing to say. Andy Milligan was born in 1929. He was an army brat, and if there was any defining aspect to his childhood, it is the ferocity of his hatred for his mother. Later in life, he would write, "The woman my father married," that's how he referred to his mother, "was a real sick individual. She was the one who ruined the family, very neurotic. And my father never said anything. He was weak. It was the usual, strong woman, weak male. She was a monster, very fat, ate continually, 300 and some pounds. She was so fat that I had to clean her toes out." For the record, I don't know what that means. "Her feet were always dirty." Okay, I guess that's what it means. "I don't like fat women. I've never had a fat person yet who didn't open my refrigerator or walk into my kitchen." It's interesting that he wrote "had a fat person" and not "met a fat person." Anyway, again, not sure what that means. Not sure I want to. But apparently Milligan's mom was quite a piece of work. One Christmas, his father locked himself in the basement with the intention of killing himself, if only to get away from her. Milligan took an interest in theater as a young kid, building little puppet playhouses with a friend of his. But he had to hide this interest from his mom, who thought such things were sissified, or sissy shit. Once, when Andy got caught playing with matches, his mother took him to the electric stove and intentionally burned his hands on it. I can't imagine what she would have done to dissuade him from being a sissy. Her words. Andy's father was in the army, and his half-brother Harley was in the army. So Andy, after high school, joined the Navy, just because. Milligan, who was openly gay, writes, "I loved the Navy. I had a great time. I met Jack Larson, who was Jimmy Olsen on the Superman TV show, and Tab Hunter. Tab's real name, Art Galeen. He was only about 17, from an orphanage background. He used to throw parties for Navy personnel at the San Diego Ballroom. It was wild in California at the time, around 48, 49, sort of swinging.
San Diego Hotel, the wildest party. I've never seen anything like that in my life. There were nude, bronzed muscle men with 18 ribbons tied to them that went to all the tables. 18 sailors got lucky that night. I go down to Tijuana on the weekends and watch Bobby and Joyce, a dance act. He played the sailor and she played the prostitute, and they'd do House of Blue Lights, two shows a night. He was 5'4", she was 5'1", just adorable. Tijuana, a dirty roads town. Milligan ended up living with a guy in San Francisco and was preparing to go to acting school when he received word from his mother that she was very sick and he needed to get home right away. Milligan spent his entire savings getting home, only to learn that his mother was fine. She was, in fact, sitting at the kitchen table eating cookies when he entered the house. Well, there went acting school. Milligan exploded. His mother started crying. According to Milligan, in the middle of all the crying, I was tearing up some penny postcards, and she just stopped and looked at me and said, "Oh, don't do that. I can use those." Milligan told his mother he'd never see her again, and she said, and I quote, "You'll come crawling back." He said he would never see her again until the day she died. And he did not. Can't say he wasn't a man of his word. Speaking of Andy's words, he wrote the following. At the funeral, this stupid pastor, we never went to church, he was talking about how great she was, and I just stood up and said, "She was a bitch." My father slugged me one. I guess he really did love her. After my mother died, my father remarried. I have a Japanese stepmother and half-sister. My real sister, Louise, was trying to take the house away from them through my father. So I called her a cunt, and her husband came in and cracked one of my ribs. I never went back after that. Now, just as an aside, these days, we call all this stuff emotional trauma. Milligan hitchhiked into New York, where he spent the first few nights sleeping in Central Park, and eventually, he got a job as an usher at the Anko Theater, a Fleabag fire trap on 42nd Street. He then threw a random ad in the newspaper, got a job as a puppeteer, touring the South in a marionette production of Aladdin and His Magic Lamp. Again, he writes, "You got a couple hundred a week, which was big bread at the time. Lived in cheap hotels. These two crazy lesbians who ran the company would scream at each other, scream at the puppeteers. It was really unpleasant. They had this big, fat lesbian friend of theirs that used to sleep on the floor of the apartment. She was the one who created the sets. She was 300 pounds. Had this rabbit that used to chew on her hair. I always thought she was bald. She had a deep voice. Looked kind of like Sydney Greenstreet. It was wild." Well, he eventually found his way back to New York, where, as an actor, he had a run-in with a pre-The Actors Studio James Dean. Apparently, they were both working on a CBS teleplay called Keep Our Honor Bright, which was a morality play about the decay that sets in after you cheat on a high school test. Apparently, James Dean said that Andy said the only way you can get a job with CBS was to, quote, "sit with your legs uncrossed and show a basket." I feel this is not related to the Easter Bunny in any way. Milligan denies the charge, but he was blackballed from CBS, no pun intended. But when God closes a door, he opens a window. Sounds to me like someone's on the toilet. But anyway, Milligan soon found himself in the off-off-Broadway theater movement. The location was a small black box theater called the Cafe Chino. Get it? Cafe Chino. The Cafe Chino came together at a weird period. It was after the beatniks, but before the hippies. But several giants of the American theater emerged from that scene, including Lanford Wilson, John Guare, not to mention Andy Milligan. One of the actors involved with the Cafe Chino scene was named Matt Baylor, who had a very astute observation about Andy. Quote, "When Andy fixed a little curl on your head, watch out. He was up to something. His dislike of most people was intense. Too intense. It was hateful. Evil. There was a mean streak to him." Milligan himself was hard-pressed to disagree. "Oh, I've had violent loves, violent hates, violent entanglements. Milligan doesn't love halfway. I love people who refer to themselves in the third person." Mm-mm-mm. Milligan found an outlet for his aggression as a director at Cafe Chino. According to the actors who worked with him, the theater became Andy's own private psychosexual S&M dungeon. He tortured his actors, emotionally and physically. It was not unusual for an actor to find himself being hit, beat, whipped on stage. One actor, Bob Dada, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, recalled,
Milligan's productions were not only exciting, but downright deadly. Johnny Dodd recalled, "Much of Milligan's vitriol was aimed at the opposite sex. I found that was a good way to get him going. Just bring a woman over to the table. Andy would just attack them. If a woman came with her fingernails done up, he would say, 'Oh, were you out whoring tonight?' But oddly, Dodd would go on to say, Andy didn't like homosexuals either. He hated them. It was a toss-up between them and women, which was worse. You would think he would have allied himself. I mean, gays would have at least accepted him, but nope, no way." Ellen Morris summed it up quite succinctly. "I wouldn't say Andy was happy. His childhood, he couldn't get away from that. All women had something he saw in them that reminded him of his mother, and he hated women." Again, Bob Dada, "Milligan always showed women in the most awful light. Bitchy, violent, demanding, demonic, aggressive, you name it. Misogyny, homophobia, self-loathing be damned. With a repertoire of actors from the Cafe Chino and money coming in from a dressmaking shop he started called the Ad Lib, Andy decided to try his hand at filmmaking. His first attempt was Before Breakfast, which was a 30-minute black-and-white film of a play he had recently directed. Then he made Vapors, another 30-minute black-and-white drama, telling the story of an awkward, ultimately unconsummated encounter between two men at the St. Mark's Baths, the then-famous gay bathhouse in New York. That said, Milligan's films were firmly and proudly exploitation. Not so much working out his trauma as constantly reliving it, exploring subjects like dysfunctional family relationships, abusive women, repressed sexuality, abusive women, homosexuality, abusive women, physical deformity, and terrible mothers, who were abusive women even to those people who weren't their kids, but also their kids, making them abusive women and terrible mothers. Andy's films had titles such as Depraved, The Naked Witch, The Promiscuous Sex, The Degenerates, The Filthy Five, Gutter Trash, Seeds of Sin, Flesh Pots on 42nd Street, and my favorite title, The Rats Are Coming, The Werewolves Are Here. In 1968, Milligan set out to make what is arguably his most famous or notorious film, The Ghastly Ones. Also, fun fact, name of a great surf band here in Southern California. The Ghastly Ones is Andy's first color film, and it is set in the 1800s at a country house where three young women arrive to claim their father's inheritance and are then gruesomely killed one by one. If there's anything positive to be said about the film, it's... well, it proves that Ed Wood is not the worst director of all time. The best summary I've read of it was on Letterboxd.com by a guy named Ira Booker. And Ira Booker wrote, "Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of some hateful twits. They headed to their dead dad's place to claim their inheritance. The place had a feral handyman. The maids were grim and dour. The couples bickered in their rooms, got picked off by the hour. There's the brown-haired guy and the brown-haired girl. And the other brown-haired guy who rapes his wife. There's the red-haired girl and the rest here on Milligan's Isle." In Stephen King's Dance Macabre, he reviews The Ghastly Ones by saying, "It's the work of morons with cameras." Milligan also got married in 1968 to a woman named Andy Hammond. This is weird, because he was gay. The wedding took place at his house on Staten Island, which was still decorated as a set for his film Seeds. Well, they got divorced a year later. Candy claimed it was because Milligan devoted all of his time to his filmmaking career. That's like divorcing one of the Shags because all they care about is the music. In 1977, with the help of some stockholders, Milligan moved into a four-story building on West 39th Street, where he started the Troupe Theater, which was described as seedy but fun. He left New York in 85 and moved to L.A., where he shot three more horror movies between 87 and 88, as well as operating another theater company, the Troupe West, which ran until 1990 and which I vaguely remember. Andy Milligan was heavily into S&M and he had very few serious relationships. The few friends that he did have were, sadly, just as emotionally troubled and dangerously disturbed as he was. There was a Vietnam veteran and ex-convict named Dennis Malvasi, who made headlines in March of 2001 when he and his wife were arrested for aiding the flight of a suspected murderer named James Kopp. Another Milligan pal, B. Wayne Keaton, known as the Human Toothpick, was a Louisiana hustler who died of AIDS in 1989. His parting gift to Milligan was to pass on the disease. He died of it in June of 1991. The tragedy of Andy Milligan is that, like Paul Winchell, the scars of his childhood were never erased, warping him well into adulthood. When analyzing these stories of Andy's mother, all well corroborated, it's obvious that she suffered some form of mental illness. It's speculated that she was at the very least bipolar and most probably suffered from something worse, maybe schizophrenia or a schizoaffective disorder. Those who know Andy speculate that he suffered from the very same maladies. If so, it's important to note that they went untreated throughout his life. Non-smoker, non-drinker, Milligan was said to react badly, violently, if anyone around him smoked cigarettes, drank alcoholic beverages, or used any type of recreational drug. Milligan also never had a driver's license, relying on public transportation wherever he lived. No wonder he didn't make it in L.A. Andy Milligan was an outcast in his family. He chose a life and career on the outskirts of society. He directed harsh, confrontational theater and made abrasive, shocking films unapologetically all of his life. His biography, published in 2001, was called The Ghastly One.
It is an historic occasion whenever Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi confront each other. Their very presence weaves a spell of mystery and horror.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready, Frankenstein. Then.
There's no modern day comparison to Alfred Hitchcock and his impact on cinema and culture. Not even cinema, but pop culture. There is a new Alfred Hitchcock Classics collection that's coming out on DVD with a ton of great extras, and it was, I guess, curated would be the word by our guest today. Please welcome Laurent Bouzereau.
And this is the sound of my voice.
This collection, which I'm going to get, features, I guess you'd call it the peak of his middle period, peak of his middle late period, Rear Window, Vertigo, Psycho, and The Birds. How did you end up, how did this responsibility fall into your lap?
I was sort of at the forefront of this revolution that happened a few years ago with home entertainment, where we started doing all those retrospective documentaries on older films. And as I was sort of doing a lot of titles with Universal,
what are some of the titles that you did?
Jaws, 1941, Scarface, E.T. Those were like all retrospective documentaries. Mm-hmm. And I said to Universal, why don't we do Psycho? I remember at the time, Robert Bloch, who had written the original
novel. Right.
And who I knew had just passed away, were feature-length documentaries. They weren't right. Little pieces that sometimes, you know, I find myself doing in other films. Those were really in-depth docs where I just literally would go to this warehouse in the valley where Universal keeps all of their archive. And it was something out of Kafka. You know, you would walk into this gigantic warehouse, which I can't imagine how hot it is in there right now.
Oh, I know.
By the way. And they would pull out all those file boxes. And I was able to retrace the history of interviewed Robin Wood, who was one of the first sort of professors or historians to write a study of the films of Hitchcock.
Uh-huh.
And he was married at the time and later on in life came out and was with a man. and rewrote his entire book to sort of match his sort of like newfound sensibility.
Oh, so he wrote a book about the work of Alfred Hitchcock as a closeted gay man.
Correct.
And then as a living freely open gay man, and it changed his perspective on the work.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
It was fascinating. And he was someone I knew first in New York when I lived there, and then went to Toronto where he was teaching for those interviews. And he was a remarkable person, extremely tough in that he had such profound understanding and love for Hitchcock.
Right.
That he made sure you knew that. and I did too. So I had a lot of affection for him, and he was just a great figure for me. And so I'm glad he's part of those discussions. So already, you know, back then I've always felt in documentaries that you have to somehow, especially when talking about older pictures, have a sense of your contemporary audience. And So my documentary on Psycho opens with Clive Barker. And I've always had that sense that in order for young people to access those stories of yesterday, particularly when it comes to Hollywood, it's always important to sort of try and have a contemporary point of view.
Well, to that end, because I recently watched your Jaws documentary. The famous story, when the shark stopped working, Spielberg had to rethink the film from a monster movie to a Hitchcock film. He had to approach it how can I tell the story by not showing it to you?
Yeah.
And that's another great example of everything that you like goes back to something before. It goes back to something before that.
And it's interesting to me that there's a lot of comparison between Jaws and the Birds. Roy Scheider in Jaws is this guy from New York who comes to this island, you know, they make a big point of it. And T.P. Hedren is this sort of city girl who comes and to this small town, almost like that lives outside the world and is attacked by birds. And it's almost like she is the cause of all this.
Uh-huh.
And then some of the scares, like when Lydia, played by Jessica Tandy, finds the body of the faucet at the faucet farm, and the sort of three shots on
the
guy with no eyes, reminds me of the shock of Ben Gardner's head,
yeah.
so there's a lot of interesting
and it's
similarities.
The bird in the 70s, there was a huge genre of nature's revenge movies.
Oh, Jaws
started. It was also just, you know, like frogs, Night of the Lepus, you know, all of these, the animals are coming, Food of the Gods, all the animals are having their revenge. It goes back to birds. It goes back to the birds.
But the birds, what's amazing about the birds and Jaws, but the birds is a metaphor.
Yeah.
The birds are a metaphor. It's not meant to be literal. The story really is a love story between this man and this woman, and this man trying to prove to his mother that this woman is worthy of him, mm-hmm. and that she's going to be gaining a daughter and not losing a son.
Right.
And therefore, in order to prove this, they have to go through some kind of a trial.
A crucible,
And the birds is it.
It's interesting also in the birds in that, and I guess we'll move backwards then, because the one I really want to drill into is Vertigo, because that's the most fascinating story from the film. You know, it's such a personal movie that was released as a big studio film, obviously, you know. For somebody who is so into structure in terms of a screenplay, The Birds has a very odd structure and a very non-committal ending.
But there's no the end at the end.
Exactly, yeah.
But you know why? Because it's a new beginning.
Mm-hmm.
She is finally accepted by the mother. And so it's a new beginning. for them. I think Hitchcock, in disguise of rather commercial movies that he's made throughout his career, mm-hmm. was an experimental director. Here is someone who started in the silent era, who was making one of his best films of his English period, called Blackmail, as sound was appearing, and he had to sort of reshoot some scenes and rethink the film because his producer said, wait a minute, when your movie comes out, there will be talkies. So what are we going to do? And your main actress is actually Czech. She can speak English properly. we can do dubbing. So he had an actress on the side.
On the set.
Mary, you know. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
She was literally dubbed as they were filming. So she was lip syncing the dialogue with someone else being recorded off screen. But so Hitchcock is an experimental director disguised as a commercial director. So I'm not surprised that you find the birds to be somewhat astructural or sort of out of his canon. But I think Psycho was experimental in that he was doing a very low budget with film with a television crew in black and white when most of the movies by then, you know, like you know, he had embraced Technicolor. I'm not surprised myself. I find that fascinating with Hitchcock that he, you know, constantly, and sometimes he didn't succeed, but would constantly surprise you. He was the one who filmed Rope all in one take.
Right. Yeah.
He's the one who pitched to his studio. Oh, I'm going to do this movie, Rear Window. I have two biggest stars, Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly. Oh, well, that must be a worldwide kind of movie. No, they're in one room. The whole movie.
Right. It's all shot on a set.
You know, you have to be very courageous to...
He was just so talented that he had to challenge himself to keep from getting bored. And once he had mastered the lavish... When you look at specifically To Catch a Thief and North by Northwest, which were, you know, the films that just before this period, you know, that's what he was known for. These giant, lavish... Technicolor, globe-trotting adventures with Cary Grant, and then to turn around and make Psycho.
That was part of his marketing. You know, let's not forget this is someone, probably, arguably, the only director of his time who was recognizable. I mean, so smart that he thought in terms of marketing, even with Psycho, you know, telling people don't reveal the ending. That's the only one we got. And really making that part of the campaign that no one will be admitted in the theater when the movie begins.
Hitchcock was really, as you said, in addition to being an auteur and a brilliant filmmaker, he was a brilliant marketing guy. And when Psycho was released, back in the time that Psycho was released, cinemas ran all day, and people would come in the middle of a movie, stay, watch it. You know, it was, you could just go in at any time. And for Psycho, they announced, it was a huge thing, that if you missed the beginning of the movie, you weren't getting in. And it was quite brilliant because people want what they don't, people want what they think they can't get. And it was quite brilliant. And there was a lot of, I think it was very influenced by William Castle.
Yeah.
Who was also, certainly not the director, that, not the director that Hitchcock was, but was a master showman and, you know, had great gimmicks to get people into the theater.
Yeah. And I think that Hitchcock backed it up with talent and something really timeless. I defy anyone to watch a William Castle movie today and not laugh.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the point. I mean, I would say that was the, well, maybe Rosemary's Baby, but yeah. No,
yeah, Rosemary's Baby.
The point of William Castle was to laugh. I mean, they're fun B drive-in movies and they're
like
great hamburgers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the, you know, it's exactly what it's supposed to be. And Hitchcock made an A film, but employed that marketing. When I said influenced by William Castle, I meant influenced by the emergo, you know, the showmanship of Castle. And the other aspect about Psycho that people don't realize today is that he killed the star at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, that was a huge shock to the audience. And there's so much about the film that is extremely daring. Not only the fact that at the beginning of the movie, you go in through a window, literally, and yeah, you discover this
young couple. In a shot, I still can't find the cut.
Yeah, and you... You know, there is Janet Leigh in her bra and slip and John Gavin bare chest. And it was very daring for the time. And then you build up what you think is kind of a complicated drama, love story. She's trying to get married with him. She steals some money. And it starts in Phoenix, you know, which is this desert, this heat. Mm-hmm. And then she gets lost on the road and it starts to rain. And through rain, she enters this universe of horror that is Norman Bates. And she enters it in water. She's killed in water and she's buried in the swamp. In
right.
The
water. Yeah.
And that really indicates to you that it's two different worlds. You know, and through that rain, you literally enter a world that is no longer what the first half hour of the movie was. And yes, the fact that she got killed, you never saw that coming because you're like, that's impossible. That would never happen. And leave it to Hitchcock to make it happen. Right.
Did he want to make this film on a low budget and kill the star at the beginning of the movie and then whatever the rest of the movie is?
Yeah, that was...
You get the feeling that once she's dead, Hitchcock's like, all right, I got to get out of this. Well, all right, how do we get out of here?
It was really interesting. I was very close to the screenwriter, Joseph Stefano, who passed on since then, but he...
Now, is it Stefano or Block that went on to work on The Outer Limits?
Stefano,
right, okay, good.
And Joe... I remember telling me, you know, the story conferences that he would have with Hitchcock. And that was from the beginning, the idea of killing the star. That was part. The rest of the movie is suspense. The thing with Janet Leigh is shock, which is two big differences.
Yes.
You know, suspense is like two people are at a table and there's a bomb underneath. And you keep cutting to the bomb and you're like, oh my God, it's going to explode. Suspense. Shock is like you're filming two people at the table and the whole thing explodes. You didn't expect that's shock. So Janet Leigh is shock and then the rest of the movie is suspense.
Mm-hmm.
Like what is going on? And
people forget and the under here's a phrase you don't get to say a lot. The underrated murder of Martin Balsam. People don't say that the way they used to. But that was also because he couldn't just willy-nilly kill everybody else. He still had to come up with Hitchcockian devices to keep it interesting. And that's an underrated scene in the movie.
It is, especially that it's filmed. Again, my notion of the first part is shock and then it's suspense is that Martin Balsam's murder is completely different from Janet Leigh's.
Exactly, yes.
The close-up on his feet going up the stairs and the door starting to open and then the overhead shot and then he falls back. And I mean, this is all suspense as opposed to the shock of Janet Leigh, like the curtain being literally pulled and there she is. I have the
book Hitchcock at Work, which is just the photos of
oh
him.
Yeah, and, fantastic. Yeah.
And Psycho specifically, it takes place in a world I wish I got to be in. Just, you know, like everybody's on set, everybody's in a tie. Like it was very professional, very, you know, it was Mad Men. It was 1962. That's my favorite kind of period. Just like, yeah, just before the 60s got weird and spooky.
I think there was a story that Billy Friedkin told me. He met Hitchcock, and I'm probably butchering the story, but that's okay. And he went up to him and said, "Oh, I'm Billy Friedkin. I just won an Oscar for The French Connection." And Hitchcock just said to him, "Real directors wear ties."
Fantastic.
Something like that. Now, whether or not it's true, or I'm thinking of someone else, maybe, I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you the only Hitchcock story I know. I'm very, very blessed and lucky that I know Mel Brooks. And Mel told me that he showed Hitchcock High Anxiety. And that's weird when you know somebody that knows, like, so I showed Hitchcock, and I was like, "Oh yeah, you knew Alfred Hitchcock. Of course you did. Of course you did. You're Mel Brooks." And the bird scene on the bench in High Anxiety, he goes, "Hitchcock, he goes, I love that you took the time and that each bird land." because comedy and suspense work the same way. They're both called gags. What's the gag?
By the way, there's a lot of humor in Hitchcock's
movie. Oh, tons. In fact, there's a really, I mean, he had a very dark sense of humor, as do I, so I love him. But like in Psycho, when Norman pushes the car with Marion Crane's body in the trunk, and he pushes it into the swamp, and it starts to sink, and then it stops. And then it goes back down.
Well, you know why it's brilliant? It's because it puts you, and not only that.
Suddenly you're relating to Norman. Suddenly you're like, oh, shit.
You're like, oh, my God, I don't want Norman to fail. Yeah. But right before that, there's also the whole, what Hitchcock used to refer to as the MacGuffin, the sort of things that people are after, which is the money that she has stolen. And when Norman comes into the bathroom after Mother has supposedly murdered Janet Leigh, the camera is behind the night table with the money wrapped into the newspaper on the foreground. And you keep going like, Norman, there's money. There's tons of money. It's right there staring at you. And then the irony is that he closes the door. The irony is that he makes one last look, notices the newspaper, and you're like, oh, my God, he's finally found the money. But no, he thinks it's just a newspaper. He grabs it and tosses it into the trunk with the body and goes in the swamp.
Right. And at the end of the day, the money is completely irrelevant.
Exactly. But yeah, that's what's so brilliant about it.
What's interesting about Psycho is here's a guy at the peak of his career and nobody wanted to pay for the movie. You know, when Hitchcock announced Psycho, Universal, which was his, Paramount was his studio.
Yeah.
They didn't want to pay for it, which is amazing that at his level of success, they still went, we don't think so.
But that's the story of the business.
Oh, no, I know that the shit sandwich is so never crazy. Stopped serving.
And I have to say, at the time, you know, if you read the book Psycho, which is really great, but that's all you read, Marion Crane, first of all, Norman Bates is not at all like he is by Tony Perkins.
He's really Ed Gein. He's really Ed Gein.
He's really Ed Gein. Marion Crane, or Mary Crane, as she's called in the book, she gets beheaded in the shower.
Right.
I mean, it's a trip. And for anything to have to mark a new benchmark in storytelling and filmmaking has to be difficult. It can't be easy, or else it would have been done already. So I'm always comforted by those stories because it's actually reassuring that someone like Hitchcock was still having trouble with each new film he wanted to make. I'm not surprised. And yet it truly takes an artist like him to have a vision for something like this.
Right.
To make it the timeless classic that it is.
They must have hated that he made so much money. Right, but I mean, his Paramount must have hated that that they turned that down. You always read those stories of, you know, the guy that Paramount passed on The Simpsons.
But they made it. It ended up at Paramount. And then,
oh, that's right. It was only shot at Universal.
Yes, and then he moved to Universal.
Right, right.
And then eventually Universal acquired the film, but it was a Paramount movie. So they did make the picture.
That's right. But he had a bigger piece of the pie than normal, which I think set him up for the rest
of his life. As he should.
Yes, it set him up for the rest of his life. And so when Psycho comes out, it's a huge hit. It's like he makes these giant Technicolor movies that are monstrous successes. And then he makes this tiny, dirty, black and white movie that a lot of critics said he's trashed his reputation. This is a blight on his career. And it's the most successful movie he's ever made. You know, that makes more money than anything ever. And the analogy is, and people forget, it was like Steven Spielberg made Jaws, this giant adventure, made a lot of money. And then he made Raiders, this giant adventure, made a lot of money. And then he made this tiny little movie called E.T. And that made more money than the other two. It was like, there is that point where he just can't lose. We can't lose.
There are few directors who in their careers are like Hitchcock and Steven Spielberg. And it feels like whatever they do, it succeeds because they have an honesty about their art that manages to be both, as I said, you know, experimental and yet true to the audience that love their films. And that's a skill that is only given to very few people.
They have an ability to speak to the public that is almost feral.
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting about what you're saying here, let's take the example of Psycho. He breaks the fourth wall several times. And it's very thematic where Janet Leigh, when she skips town with the money and she's on the road, she's literally fantasizing about what people are saying what they're going to say when they discover she stole money and stuff. She's literally looking at us and smiling and having fears. I mean, she has all kinds of emotions, but she's literally staring at the camera, which is very, very daring for the time.
Yes.
And that just sort of pulls you in, puts you in her position. Then she falls asleep on the side of the road. A cop pulls in, knocks on the window, and when she wakes up, startled, the cop looks right into the camera, right, also, but he's got big sunglasses. And you know what? They're already a foreshadowing of Mother's empty eye sockets. So no wonder should she be scared of him. Then when Martin Balsam comes into the store of John Gavin after the murder of Marion, he is literally walking into the camera looking straight at us. And guess what? Hitchcock finishes the movie with Tony Perkins as Mother,
right,
looking straight at us. So he was so bold and so aware that the audience would feel like so uncomfortable or so committed or so... there was an understanding of the craft that went beyond just normal storytelling. Those things you don't necessarily catch on the first viewing. Your self-conscious does. Oh my God, Norman Bates is just staring at me. Oh my God, this cop is staring at me. Oh my God, Janet Leigh is staring at me. But that's part of the manipulation that he was so good at of the audience.
Right.
And Psycho breaks those rules in order to lure you in a way that had never been really done before.
And to that end, Psycho is, you know, they talk about movies today being rides. You know, like a lot of Spielberg's films were derided as, it was more an amusement park ride than a movie. It's, you know, Psycho is one of those early films that it's wound up tighter than a $2 watch. And the audience is played like a harp.
And yes, Psycho, and by the way, it's also,
you start watching that movie, you go, this what?
It's also a ride on Universal's.
Yeah, I know it is. I know. I'm dimly remembering when I could go to Universal. But the audience, once the first frame, once that movie starts, you're in. And that's what I love from the writing point of view, is that
he was so brilliant, it's the only word you can use, at involving the audience. And as you say, in the movie, changing the audience's perspective as to who they are cheering for and supporting. Norman Bates murders the heroine of the movie, and then within 5 minutes, he has you relating to Norman.
Absolutely. And I think all aspects of Hitchcock's movies, and I think in Psycho you see it, but you also hear it, the importance of the music as a almost a danse macabre of violence as performed and composed by Bernard Herrmann,
right,
is not music. It's literally an additional voice and character in the film. It's a scream. It's something that goes hand in hand with what the characters are feeling. In a way, John Williams would do the same thing with Jaws when, as you said, the shark wasn't working and you had to constantly remind the audience of its presence, and only through music and those yellow barrels popping up did you achieve that. And again, it's Stephen and Hitchcock
and that understanding
of the power of everything that feeds into cinema, that it's not just the visual, it's the music, it's the performances, incredible acting, incredible inspired casting. And it's
yeah, always, people don't realize how important Anthony Perkins is to Psycho success.
Oh.
That he wasn't Ed Gein, that it was, he was a heartthrob. He was it was like Justin Timberlake. Casting Justin Timberlake as your serial killer.
And it's kind of tragic in the case of Perkins in that I think he never quite shed that character, and that he the other movies he made, he often played, you know, a similar version of Norman Bates, whether it was in Mahogany, where he's like this photographer, or Crimes of Passion, Ken Russell movie, or Psycho 2 and Psycho 3 and Psycho 4.
But by the way, I will say, Psycho 2, a terrible idea for a movie. Let's do a sequel to Psycho. It's a good movie.
Oh, I totally agree with you.
Yeah, it's not a bad movie at all.
It should have been called Psycho 2 T-O-O.
Yeah. But it's a complete, and my hat's off to the director is not like I forget, you'd know the name of the director.
Richard Franklin.
Like, not one of the greats that you hear about.
But Richard knew Hitchcock.
And he said, I'll do Psycho 2. God bless him. It's like Jeanne Swark directing Jaws 2. Yeah, I'll do it.
You mean Jeanne Swark.
Forgive me.
That's okay. You know, Richard Franklin knew Hitchcock.
I didn't call him Giannot. Come on, give me some credit.
Oh, yes, exactly.
My mother would have called him Giannot.
Yes, exactly. But Psycho 2 is a totally honorable.
Yeah, it really is. I remember seeing it when it came out. Like, I remember walking out of the theater and saying to my brother, like, that was pretty good.
I saw it in Westwood the summer it came out.
It was the summer of 83, I believe.
And now it's the movie theater is a drugstore.
Yeah. I saw it in Hyannis, Massachusetts, and I think the movie theater is now a mattress store.
Yeah. Sad.
But Psycho 2 is one of those things that, you know, it's kind of like calling your band the New Beatles. But danged if it didn't work. I there's 2 points that I wanted to make, but I really want to spend some time talking about Vertigo.
Okay.
But the one point that I wanted to make was, as you're talking about the importance of music in Psycho and how it related and how it orchestrated the audience's emotions, as John Williams did in Jaws. And then you naturally go to The Birds, which is a cousin of Jaws, and one of the aspects of that movie is there is no music.
Exactly.
It's all atonal
sound design.
Sound design, but done by Bernard Herrmann, if I'm not mistaken.
He was. It was done by two other people, but he was a supervisor.
He was involved. Yeah,
because the sound design for the birds is incredible. It's almost like a dance. It's almost So there was a lot of work done. There's actually a scene where you don't see the birds and they're attacking the house. And you hear this.
Right, it's horrifying, yeah.
And at some point when they stop, it just goes into this weird, almost bizarre conclusion sound-wise. It's brilliant. It's, I mean, talk about experimental. I don't think Hitchcock knew quite how to make the movie until he finished the film. And that's the thing that's amazing, you know, in terms of adventures in filmmaking. Filmmakers who sign on to do a film and they have a pretty good idea as to what they want or what they don't want, but there's going to be a lot of discovery along the way.
Right.
And in the case of the birds, I don't know that he really knew that it was going to be that successful of a technical endeavor.
Right. But that must have been exciting for him to go, if this is going to work.
For sure. And you know, he is mixing on the Jungle Jam, that famous scene.
Right.
Some of the birds are real and some of them are cutout birds and fake birds.
Yeah.
There was a lot of choreography that went into all those incredible sequences. I would say of the collection, that's my favorite. The birds hits me emotionally. It's I think the discovery of a new actress like Tippi Hedren is incredible. The relationship, the thematic of the mother, the colors, the framing, I cannot see one fault in that movie. It's incredible.
It's interesting. And Tippi Hedren, and this will take us perfectly. You know, Tippi Hedren was selected by Hitchcock to be the star of The Birds, sort of plucked from obscurity, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct, from a commercial. By his wife.
By his wife, Alma.
Yeah.
Who was an underrated collaborator.
For sure. I wrote a book about her with Pat Hitchcock, their daughter, actually.
Oh, really? What's the book?
It's called Alma, The Woman Behind the Man. Alma Hitchcock.
I'm going to go on to Libris right now and get
I'll
I
do have copy.
No, I'll buy, I do have Me and Hitch. I do have Tippi's book. The first film in this collection is Rear Window, which starred Jimmy Stewart, one of his... Him and Cary Grant sort of alternated as stand-ins, the Tom Hanks and Brad Pitt of their day, as stand-ins for the Hitchcock lead. And then they all starred Grace Kelly, who he loved, purportedly, or was certainly obsessed with. And then Grace Kelly married the Prince of Monaco, moved to Monaco, and Hitchcock tried unsuccessfully for the rest of his career to replace Grace Kelly.
I think he was very successful with Tippi Hedren. I think she is...
Not emotionally.
Oh, I don't agree with you.
Really?
I have to say, I think she is absolutely amazing in The Birds and Marnie.
Oh, I'm not talking about Tippi. I'm talking about he never replaced Grace Kelly in his heart emotionally. I think that he grew to resent Tippi Hedren for not being Grace Kelly. That's what I was trying to say.
I guess. And I don't think that's entirely true. Yeah.
He did throw birds at her for a couple of days.
Well, he tried to strangle Grace Kelly with a phone cord Fallon for Murder.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
He tried to have a serial killer chop her up in Rear Window.
Yeah. But didn't Hitchcock literally threw standing off camera like Tippi, Tippi had a very complicated relationship with Alfred Hitchcock. But that's what the movie Vertigo is about. I mean, Vertigo is an incredibly personal film
dressed up as a big budget, lavish psychological thriller about Jimmy Stewart falls in love with a woman. She dies, or so he thinks. And then he sets about trying to replicate her.
Out of guilt.
Yeah. And based on a French novel called Among the Dead, if I'm not mistaken.
From Amongst the Dead, D'entre les Morts, and promise I'm not going
to... I could have pronounced that perfectly.
And I'm not going to ask you to even mention the name of the authors, which is Pierre Boileau and Thomas Narcejac. They were the French authors who wrote...
But not Pierre Boulle.
Not Pierre Boulle. Pierre Boileau.
Boileau.
Yeah, Pierre Boulle wrote Planet of the Apes
and Bridge on the
River. Why? But Pierre Boileau and Thomas Narcejac were a pair of authors who were also screenwriters. They wrote Eyes Without a Face, a famous horror movie.
Right.
And they're also,
and a famous Billy Idol song.
Yeah. And they're also responsible for Diabolique, which influenced Psycho.
Psycho, completely, yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of funny how everything...
The director of Diabolique was hailed as the French Hitchcock, and it really pissed off Hitchcock.
Yeah. Henri-Georges Clouzot. I don't think he was anywhere near Hitchcock's sound, but I have to say, Diabolique is a good film, and it has a great twist. But if you compare them to Psycho, to make Hitchcock feel better from Beyond the Grave, is that Diabolique is a cult film and a cult favorite, but in no way is it as powerful as Psycho is today still.
Well, here's my analogy for Diabolique and Psycho in terms of the hailing of Henri-Georges Clouzot as the next Hitchcock. One of my favorite little fun facts. In 1967, in the United States, the Monkees sold more albums than the Beatles.
Okay. Love that. All right.
Nothing against the Monkees. Did Hitchcock know he was making a movie about himself at the time?
I would say that anyone interested in acting should embrace Jimmy Stewart, because he made four films with Hitchcock: Vertigo, Rear Window, Rope, and The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Right.
And he never played twice the same character with him.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely incredible to see him in Vertigo and then watch him in Rear Window. It's a complete opposite kind of performance, completely different movies. I mean, Rear Window is almost farcical to some degree.
It has
a lot of humor.
We have to talk about Rear Window for a couple seconds now.
Yeah.
One, something I just realized about Rear Window. I can't wait. So Jim Stewart has a broken leg and he's in a wheelchair. He's confined to his apartment. His girlfriend is Grace Kelly, who's much younger than he is, head over heels in love with him, and he's a pain in the ass to her the entire movie. He's grouchy, he's crabby, he's a pain in the ass. Last night, I am recovering from shoulder surgery. So I'm in my right arm is in a sling for 4 weeks. I can't do anything with it. My girlfriend is younger than I am, very beautiful. I've been a pain in the ass since I came home from the hospital. I've been just a crabby pain in the ass. And I just realized, oh my God, we're living Rear Window. That's the problem.
I only have one word of advice for you. Do not look at your window.
Well, the other thing I love, the brilliant casting of Raymond Burr, that movie. We can talk about Raymond Burr all day.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. I would say that Hitchcock, usually his villains, if you think James Mason, if you think Norman Bates, are much more seductive and less creepy. And Raymond Burr definitely, as Thelma Ritter said, He's got the kind of face that wouldn't get him a second loan or something.
Yeah. And he's very susceptible to flashbulbs.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes. But I love, like, when he's very threatening to Grace Kelly, when she breaks into his apartment. That's what I meant when I said, you know, he potentially would have killed her if the cops had not showed up.
Yes. Yeah.
And Jimmy Stewart had not been looking out to the window. But
and you know what might have been behind his cat? And I don't know this. Can Grace Kelly work her magic on Raymond Burr? That character is not a sexual character.
But
and I wonder if that played into why he cast him.
That's possible. I mean, the thing that's for sure is that, as you mentioned, this is the story of a man who is refusing and rejecting the advances of this perfect woman. And she loves him for the right reasons. And he's convinced that because he's a photographer and a reporter, she's never going to be able to follow him on one of his trips. And that would be the end of it. So therefore, the whole movie is for her to prove him wrong. And by proving him wrong, she will marry him. And you know what? Outside his window is all kinds of possible relationships. You have a single woman down there named Miss Lonely Hearts. You have a young married couple. You have the nagging wife and Raymond Burr. You have the single man who is trying to write a love song, but he's having right. so much trouble with it.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's all those scenarios for Jimmy Stewart to say, okay, I'm seeing all those different possibilities out there. Which one am I? And the thing that's so interesting is what Grace Kelly wants the most, not only to prove to him that she is an adventuress just like him, but she wants that ring on her finger.
Right.
And guess
yeah.
what? She is going to go and get it from the killer across the way.
Right. That's amazing. I never.
It's all right. connected. And because he killed his wife and he chopped up her finger and he kept her ring.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately how the killer is
undone,
guilty,
yeah.
proven guilty. So it's so amazing how the thematic is completely organic to everything. It's everything's connected. Mm-hmm. And you know, the same thing in Psycho, just going back to Psycho, but you know, Psycho is about a mother who was domineering her son. Well, the first scene between Janet Leigh and John Gavin, they talk about having him come over and I'll put mother's picture on the mantle.
Right.
And
right.
then after the meal, what are you going to do? Turn mother's pictures to the wall?
Right.
And then when she goes to her office and meets with her co-worker played by Patricia Hitchcock, and he calls, right. Teddy called, then my mother called to see if Teddy called. So Teddy, you assume, is her husband, and her mother is totally mm-hmm. dominated. So it's so amazing that Hitchcock is constantly telling you, pay attention, because that's the theme of my movie. It's mm-hmm. mother. In Rear Window, it's marriage.
Mm-hmm. And Vertigo is obviously about obsession. What was his relationship with Kim Novak compared to his relationship with Grace Kelly, Tippi Hedren, Janet Leigh?
You know, Kim Novak, recently I saw her on TV.
It's amazing these people are still with us.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to document.
Yeah.
Some of them.
I believe Scorsese says Vertigo is his favorite Hitchcock film.
I'm not surprised, because it's from a cinematic standpoint, it's all about colors and it's about style. Mm-hmm.
It's visually gorgeous. It's very, there's a lot of bass notes in that movie. It's a very sort of downbeat tone.
I'll tell you something. I make a claim that it's not my favorite Hitchcock film because it challenges logic too much for me. And I had kind of an epiphany that I'm going to share with you, and you're probably going to think I'm completely crazy. But that's how I reconcile myself with Vertigo. I had two big plot problems with the movie. The movie opens with a chase on rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
This bad guy, a cop is after him, And Jimmy Stewart, also a detective, is after running. And then Jimmy Stewart trips on one of the roofs and falls, and he's hanging onto a gutter, right? The cop stops chasing the bad guy, tries to help Jimmy Stewart, but Jimmy Stewart has vertigo and causes the guy to fall over and right. die. And then Hitchcock has a big close-up on Jimmy Stewart and fades to black of him hanging on the gutter. And then you cut to him and his pseudo-girlfriend, Barbara Belgedes, and they're talking, and you never saw him being rescued, or how did he stay suspended? And that has always been a big, big plot problem for me. I don't understand.
I can tell you, he was rescued by the same people that brought King Kong to New York.
And then there's another thing in the film that always rubbed me wrong was so Kim Novak as Madeline dies, so we think, and then Jimmy Stewart just happens to be walking by, and there is Judy Barton, played by Kim Novak, and it happens that they're one of the same person. And I could never buy that coincidence of him bumping into her again. And so when I rewatched the movie a couple of nights ago, I figured out why that is. It's because when Jimmy Stewart is hanging and he fades to black, actually, Jimmy Stewart dies.
Dies.
And the whole movie is some kind of purgatory.
Okay.
That is for him to get over something, one final step to, if you will, heaven. In fact, at the very end of the movie, when Kim Novak, for no reason, falls off the clock tower.
The clock tower, yeah.
It's a nun, therefore very religious figure.
Right.
Who says, "I've heard voices." And then the last shot is Jimmy Stewart going off the clock tower, looking down as if embracing heaven. Suddenly, he's free.
I think that's completely legit. I buy that 100%. The collection is the Alfred Hitchcock Classics Collection. It's a new 4K Ultra HD combo pack of Rear Window, Psycho, The Birds, and Vertigo. There is a ton of bonus stuff. I mean, I have all the movies. I'm buying this for the bonus stuff. And that's the drag of streaming, is there's no bonus stuff. You know, that's, this stuff is still important. And it's so good, and it's available now. And you curated it. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by the Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you enjoyed the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com?